Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahako Monel Bay. And this evening, we will be dealing with the Ouachita Moors. Who are the Ouachita Moors? We have a special guest who will be with us this evening, Brother R.A. Umar S. Bay. You've probably seen him quite often on YouTube. He's brought up a tremendous amount of information. I've watched it over and over and over. Because at the time it first came out, it was quite extraordinary. I also got a chance to meet him in person right there in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, a couple of weeks ago. But he's going to be with us this evening. We're going to be dealing with the following questions. Who are the Ouachita Moors? Who are the Ouachita? Are these people Indians? How long have the Ouachita been in America? Are the Ouachita recorded in the Bible? Who built the pyramids and wrote hieroglyphics in the Americas? Who were the first people in the Americas? Who are the oldest people on the planet? Who are the rightful owners of the Americas? If the natives of America are Indians, who are the people in the land called India? These questions and much more we're going to examine this evening. And but starting off, ladies and gentlemen, I first want to mention that we're offering our free articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game and How to Play, and Secrets of America. And the way you access that, just send me an email. Send me those free articles you mentioned. That's TARHAKA53@hotmail.com. TARHAKA53@hotmail.com. And I rush that right on to you. Hold on.
Okay. Just what is TARHAKA's Archive? TARHAKA Archives is a collection of some of the most beneficial information in the country. And the way we do this is we put this in your possession, and we walk you through getting the job done. Whatever it is that you're dealing with, if you're dealing with your kids in education, if you're dealing with mortgage companies, if you're dealing with bankers, if you're dealing with your light and water company, credit card companies, regardless of what it is, that is the way this thing is designed, because everybody in this country, especially people of African descent, need a power base inside your home. So to access TARHAKA's Archives, you simply go to www.TARHAKAArchives.org and contact me after you get through with that. Area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and we get you in there. That's TARHAKAArchives.org. Okay? That's what it's all about. Thank you.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, the chat room is open, and for those of you who like to call in with questions or comments, the number is 310-982-4184, and that's the call-in number, and go ahead and follow the prompts on your phone and raise your hand, and we'll recognize you. It appears that my guest has arrived, and we'll go ahead and open up the line. Brother Bay, are you with us?
Yes, sir. Brother, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. You're coming across loud and clear. Appreciate you being with us, brother, and I really enjoyed my visit there. You're quite an extraordinary person. but before we get started with the Washington talk, could you tell us about those bees you have up there, man?
Oh, the bees are doing lovely, brother. They're, all the different colonies are expanding. We caught two new swarms this past week and got them into a nest in their new homes, and they're going to start producing honey this season.
Okay. Now, how do you do, what you do? Just set up a, you set up your box and they, just, how do you get them over there? I mean, I see them when I was there. I seen them, but I was wondering how is it that they know to come to this particular house?
Well, they actually, they're just flying around swarming, looking for somewhere to go oftentimes because in the springtime, a colony will start producing new queens, and those queens will leave and take bees with them, and they'll swarm and go out and develop a new colony. They're just nothing more than procreation, expanding, being more. So the bees expand population, and I go out and I can catch them in an area they shouldn't be, in somebody's yard, somebody's house. We put them in a proper beehive, and we nurse them, and we take care of them, and they produce honey, and we send it around the world.
Okay. All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know that I actually seen this operation, and the bees, you know, you don't bother them, they don't mess with you. And I certainly appreciate you being on, brother, and I want to say I commend you on the PowerPoint presentations you've done and the information that you put up on YouTube. It's very, very interesting. But on the broadcast today, can you tell us who the Washita Moors are?
The Washita Moors. Okay. The Washita Moors, M-U-U-R, Moor, are the people indigenous to the Washita Valley. When you talk about who people are and nationality, you're really speaking about geography. When you say the word Washita, you're talking about a specific geographic location on the planet you can locate and identify. You talk about Moor, you're talking about, once again, another nationality, you're talking about a location. And you talk about Washita, you're talking about a place that is the so-called Southern America, Southern United States, along the Washita River. And in Washita, for Washita Moor, is any land that's drained by what you call the Mississippi or Mississippi River. So Washita is all the land. You go from the Gulf of Mexico up into Canada. You are now in land that at one point was inhabited, developed by ancient Moors, mound-building, pyramid-building, earthen pyramid-building people who we call ourselves indigenously Moors, M-U-R, because that's based on a land called Mu. And when I say Mu, I have in no way tie into the Western European concept of Lemuria or Mu. When ancient people say Mu, that was the name of the whole planet in the beginning. Mu.
Okay.
That's an ancient term. If you go back into ancient, the oldest languages, into Kiswahili and before then, you'll find Mu being a very prominent name and term used throughout history.
Okay. All right. Now, I just left Baton Rouge, and while I was there, I seen quite a few mounds. I even seen one. We was going up on the on-ramp onto the expressway, and the brother pointed out to me that was one of the mounds, and I took photographs and stuff of it. Now, now these mounds that they were building, was these what were they used for? Were they like underground houses, or what was that?
First of all, the mounds are very practical at first. So you're talking about people building things 10,000 years or 10 million years ago, and there was really no beginning, but the mounds always served a practical purpose. To this day, mounds serve a practical purpose everywhere we go. In ancient days, it would only be speculation for me to say exactly the purpose, but an examination of their use worldwide, you know, you look at the pathology of them being constructed, oftentimes you found these locations termed as mounds are really built on places that are energy vortexes. So beyond being a structure, man-made structure, the very location, like location of Al-Mecca, what the Western world calls Poverty Point up in North Louisiana. That location there is an energy vortex. You know, in Nashville, Tennessee, you have many earthen mounds that were built there that later on Westerners and Americans came in and built on locations in the past 200 years that were occupied 5 and 10,000 years ago. Here in Louisiana, there are several institutions built upon sites that 5, 10,000 years ago were occupied by ancient Moors, Washitas, Tunicas, all those different names they give to indigenous people, Choctaw, Tacopaw, you name a name. They all are Washitas. They're all Moors, I mean, across the land. So you talk about the pyramids being built, the mounds being built, you can find them all over so-called North America, up into Canada, New York to California, Washington State, Florida, in Mexico, down through the all Central America into South America, even in Caribbean islands. You can go across in Japan and find them. You had them all along the Nile River. They called them, they were just silt pyramids, silt mounds, built of silt from the Nile Valley. So the idea of a earthen altar is nothing new. Anyone who goes to the Bible and reads the Torah or the Pentateuch, or what we call the Old Testament, can easily see even in the Christian and Jewish and Islamic, that Judeo-Christian Islamic doctrine speaks of building altars of earth, you know, for worship and burnt offering and sacrifice and that kind of thing. So the idea of an earthen altar is nothing new. What you find is that in modern history, it's just been hidden from people's knowledge or been disguised by calling these earthen pyramids mounds and by marginalizing their significance by calling them Indian mounds. So you understand these structures have existed for thousands of years. When the Americans first came here, there were all kind of exploration into who actually built them, where they came from, because they all demonstrated some type of scientific advanced study or advanced scientific knowledge of whoever built these. So it was not just a matter of there was a mound built. These mounds are part of communities, few cities that had suburbs. And in each one, you had different mounds of different heights. You had the, I guess they would call it the aristocracy or the leadership. It lived upon these ancient temples and mounds, and that's found all over. I mean, you go up to outside St. Louis at Cahokia, go all through the state of Ohio. The city of Michigan was once the city of Detroit in Michigan was a mound city. The capital of Madison, Wisconsin, a mound city. Go through Iowa, Des Moines. Go through the whole state of Iowa. You have earthen mounds built in the shape of animals. And even prehistoric animals, pterodactyls and animals that don't even exist, elephants. You find these earthen structures built not only in different formations and shapes, but the formations are significant. They might be a duplication of a stellar constellation in the sky or some other scientific quantity. Or if you find structures built with perfect cardinal coordination, north and south reference, even you'll find it with the bird mound up in Almeca bird mound, known as Poverty Point. That bird flies on the cardinal direction from the east, flying to the west. So if someone to take an aerial view of it, you would see a bird flying from the east, going to the west, and trailed by rings, concentric rings. And so when you talk about the mounds, who built them, and where they come from, that in itself might be a four-year study, a 20-year study. You cannot even isolate that down because most of them have been discovered and destroyed without being properly documented.
Okay. Now, did the Ouachita, do we have knowledge concerning the Ouachita building pyramids?
I didn't understand the question. Forgive me.
I say, do we have any information in regards to the Ouachita building pyramids?
Brother, every time you look at a mound, you must understand you say pyramid. What is a pyramid? Many people think a pyramid is this triangular stone building in Egypt and along the Nile River, and that truly is a pyramid. But you must understand the origin of the word pyramid, and that's actually not an indigenous word. The actual indigenous word for the structure was actually called Merkut. Makut, M-U-R-K-U-T, Makut, M-U-R-K-O-T. Makut is the indigenous name from Al-Kebalan, which we call Africa or Mexican, for the structure called the pyramid. So did the Washita build pyramids? Of course they built pyramids. When you look at the empirical definition of the word pyramid, which comes from the Latin pyro, meaning fire, and mid, fire in the middle, every earthen mound you see is a pyramid, because once you pile that dirt there, it's going to create fire in the middle and create a dynamic of heat in there. And when you study the ancient people of Al-Mecca, you'll find they built earthen urns where they built ovens under the ground, under mounds. That's how they cooked their food. When you go and study the archaeological research that's been done, digging into these ancient sites, what they find is not a village of hunters and gatherers and wanderers. They're finding permanent structures. They're finding floors. They're finding post holes. They're finding ovens and all kinds of things. And they use these artifacts that they find, locations they find, to date and radiocarbon these locations. And right here in so-called Louisiana, they've dated sites going back way beyond 6,000 years, long before the birth of Jesus Christ, or even before the birth of the mythical or historical or parenthetical Adam and Eve. So understand the so-called mounds, the earthen pyramids here in North America and South America, predate history. They're quote-unquote prehistoric. They don't register. When you look at the actual studies of archaeological findings in the state of Louisiana, there's obviously been a deliberate cover-up by some of the scientists, simply because they knew they would not get recognition, or they were trying to avoid being condemned, or somebody losing credibility for touching an area that's considered to be outside standard accepted levels of study and scholarship.
Okay.
The mounds are outside the scope of what Western history accepts as history. Okay, you talk about the study. You talk about the existence of black civilizations in North America, not savages, not hunters, not people who can be conquered and reduced to servitude, but people who had civilization are superior to anything that existed in Europe or Rome or Greece. Right here in North America, it becomes frightening. So that's not something to be discussed. But hopefully, in the very near future, in the next few weeks, we hope, all this will be broken open and we'll be able to exercise our right of self-determination and self-dignity as indigenous people. So when you say the word Washita Moore, I often see the word Washita Moore, and they spell Moore, M-O-O-R, and that is a fine spelling of the word Moore, but it is actually incorrect to say Washita Moore with two O's. The Washita are Moore. The Moore refers to our brothers and sisters who emanate from the continent. And the word Moore actually comes with a word that Europeans chose to put on us, describing the darker people throughout Europe when Europeans actually came out of their dark ages and found the Moors in Spain, bringing civilization back to the so-called continent of Eurasia or subcontinent of Europe. Because from my perspective, Europe is not really a continent in and of itself. Eurasia is also part of Eurasia. So to call Europe a continent, in reality, is incorrect. I'm more likely to call Greenland the continent before I call Europe, but that's only in my choice, because Europeans have the right to self-determination to call it what they choose to, and I respect that. But being a scientist and being a purist, it's very obvious that Europe is not a continent. And I'll just digress back to the issue that the mound builders here in Washita Parish are Moors. Washita Moors spelled with a U, based on the fact that we see the planet, the world, as being a place called Mu. When you talk about the Washita, we came up in the wash. On the coast of California, so-called California, the Washita came up in the wash. So there's a whole theory of Turtle Island, and what you call Turtle Island is Mu, and how the waters sink, and we have all these stories of Atlantis and Mu, which I personally do not knock, believe. I don't even care. They're irrelevant to me. If people want to fantasize with them or play with them, that's fine. I like to deal with reality and deal with things that I can actually I can feel. It's all a matter of each one's intuition. Some things just don't feel right, and I'd rather not deal with them, because once you get exposed to truth, it's impossible to fall back on the nonsense sometimes. You understand what
I'm saying? Oh, yeah.
Okay, so Moors, we talk about Washita Moors. I myself, years ago, became a member of the Moorish Science Temple of America, you know, founded by our noble prophet, Noble Drew Ali. So someone who's a member of the Moorish Science Temple and a Washita might call himself a Washita Moor. But the term, when you say Washita, when speaking of the indigenous people of the Washita that dug the Maunya, call themselves Mu or Moor. So you hear about Washita that dug the Maunya. That is a land. Down here in what they call Louisiana, Washita is a physical location. Dug the Maunya is a physical location. There are actually two rivers. You can go get between those two rivers. So when people try to discount us or laugh at us or try to disregard us, they can never disregard the fact that their Washita dug the Maunya is a region. And not only is it a region, it's a region where you find the oldest earthen mounds in North or South America. The oldest cities with earthen mounds that have been recorded have been found right here in so-called Louisiana, or what we call the Washita. Now, there are pyramids, earthen pyramids, all over the country. Let's say you have them in Arizona, you have them in California, you can name a state, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma. Arkansas is full of ancient earthen cities. They're in New York. Florida is full of them. The coast of Florida, Georgia, you have the Muscogee people there who built earthen altars. All over the place. And beyond the Washita indigenous Moors who built pyramids here, understand, long before the Europeans came to the east coast of what they call the United States, Moors had been here for thousands of years. Moors brought Columbus here, and he never got to the east coast of the United States. So Moors have set up settlements along the coast of what they call the United States long before the first pilgrims got here, long before the first Celts, Vikings, you name those European wanderers and explorers, they all arrived and met Moorish settlements, M-O-O-R-I-S-H, Moorish settlements along the eastern shores of what is now considered the United States of America. If you go and study the work of the great historian, the Washita historian, Moorish sister, Denise Wilson Eel, she often traveled with the Empress in the early 90s, and the Empress would go to the Native American gatherings in Oklahoma. Sister Denise Wilson Eel would go along with the Washita historian, and she wrote many articles. She shared her research on English newspapers in the 1600s, reporting skirmishes between the Christians and the Moors and the Christians and the Indians, and using the term Indian and Moor interchangeably as if they were the same people. So we know that when the first British got here, the Pilgrims got here, in the 1600s, they encountered Moorish settlements whom they had to battle just for survival. So the presence of Moors in so-called North America, as we call it, Washita, is well documented. The presence of the mound builders is well documented. It's just not properly broadcast or being taught to the public, and that is our responsibility. We cannot rely on a system predicated on our people being inferior and them being superior to shed light on any evidence of our greatness. So that is our duty and our responsibility, which I personally have no problem doing my part.
Okay. All right. Well, brother, I certainly appreciate you giving us that backdrop, and that's very, very important information. I'm right here in Jacksonville, Florida. But down here, we have a 40 miles off the coast of Florida, right in the Atlantic Ocean. We got a 400-foot-high pyramid. Fishermen take you out there. And some certain times of the year, you can ride right up in and look right through the water and see it. And it's right there, but it's blocked out the media. And it's something else that I noticed when it comes to our ancient story in this land is they can say Egyptians, they can talk about mounds, they can talk about pyramids, but it's never associated with we're black, or black people. You know, it's always like we'll talk about this, but we don't want to connect this to a particular race of people, even though we know what people did it, we're not mentioning it. But you mentioned the Empress. Could you tell us about her?
Her Royal Highness, Verity Tell, Washington, a ghost in Ellen Bay, the Empress of the Washington, the Mountain Empire. Yes, I can tell you about her, just a little bit, though. Mm-hmm. But you understand, once again, that's the talk about the Empress, you would take, you know, you're talking about a 10-year course. I mean, what can I say about her in a short time? Other than that she herself was divinely guided. What she did was not of her own will. And what she did was very awesome. And in hindsight, even greater, the time when we were around her, well, a lot of people around the Empress, the Empress was able to rally people together. She was a unifier. In spite of her people may have seen a reputation of being fiery, the Empress was able to bring together people of differences and be that ancient peacemaker. I mean, the Washita, the ancient ones are known as the peacemakers. You know, so the Empress was in her day, and when she was very active in the 80s and 90s, and she was a peacemaker, and she first started working actually in politics. She was a mayor. She worked with several senators writing legislation. She worked with President Reagan, I know for sure, and then Muskie worked with several politicians. So the Empress herself was united on the political level. So she herself was able to organize the Washita imperial nation and get international recognition. She was able to unite very extreme pockets of American people, and she was able to bring black nationalists into meetings with white nationalists and separatists and bring these groups together and have them sit on a table and actually be civil and respectful and even, you know, dine and joke and break bread. So the Empress, when she was at her height, was able to bring together people, and I think in some way it actually frightened the federal officials to see brothers from the Nation of Islam and from skinhead groups and from other white nationalist patriot movements back in the 90s all uniting in the Washita around the idea of protecting the sovereignty of a black woman. Oh, please. So the Empress was just great. I mean, I can go on and on about her. The most important thing about the Empress is she's able to go out and achieve a goal and then publish a book about it. So if you want about the Empress, I'd advise everyone to go out and somehow acquire her book and understand the essence of her book called Return of the Ancient Ones, published in 1993. I know it's difficult to locate, but I know myself I found it online. Someone has posted it online as a free PDF or free ebook. So I found it there recently. But whatever it takes, the Empress wrote a book called The Return of the Ancient Ones that outlines her 30-year quest to recover documents that her grandmother, the previous Empress, had left her regarding her family's heritage and land rights of the Washita people. And the Empress went about, you know, at the death of her grandmother in the 1960s, she began to gather documents her grandmother had left for her in different locations. She put together some work, and she was able to go out and achieve what most people believe to be impossible, and that was she was able to achieve having the state of Louisiana land office return to her title to part of the land that her family owned in the name of the Washita. And at that moment, there was a change in reality for the Washita Nation in that we now had recognition of our rights to land. And at that point, she called all of us back home. So in 1992, I myself and many people returned back down here to the Washita. And I know I stayed there for about 5 years, working with the Empress, studying, traveling around the world with her. And in the course of that event, many people came down here and worked with her. Truly not enough, but the few came down here. Still, we still meet sometimes. We still work together. And we still are true to the agenda she set forth. Even now, if you came here, you saw the things the Empress told us to do, we are still doing. We have set up our own education system, our own production system, our own centers for providing basic needs that we need. So collectively, we are putting together a model that we hope once we get the proper financing, we can duplicate all over the nation. So at this point down here in the Washington, the Empress had set an agenda for us to develop a community, a Washington community. So when people wanted to come to visit the Ouachita, they would have a place to come and develop a community so that the elders could come to a place, and instead of going to a retirement home or being just neglected or not cared for, have a place. Any elder who wanted to come home have a place to come to and be cared for, and then have a place for children who need somewhere to go, be it school, daycare, could come, and those elders who are able to could go and spend time with the children. So we have a facility, as in the ancient days, where while the young people were out working or hunting, the elders kept the children, okay? So now you have the children keeping the elders, the elders keeping the children, and we're returning to an ancient tradition. So when the Empress, I remember she first set up facilities in the Monroe area, the first thing she set up was a cultural center. And in the cultural center, she set up a facility for women to come and do some production. They did sewing. They did everything they could to make stuff because she knew the nation had to become productive and self-sufficient, because the main part of sovereignty is not relying on other governments. You know, once your government becomes independent financially, now you're really talking about sovereignty. Before then, you will still be dependent on another nation. So it was truly moving to develop institutions, not laws, but institutions, education, politics, government, and she set up the government. But Empress was phenomenal in her accomplishments. Empress actually set up a complete government and had us set up a government in which we were able to have, you know, ministries of information, ministries of transportation, ministries of agriculture, banking, all those things were set up. So we had a nation in place. And ultimately, we were able to join other indigenous nations and travel around the world and actually go over to Geneva, Switzerland, where we're able to take part in the elaboration of what has been now ratified as the Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People. And at the time we were over there, I never imagined it would ever get completed. But one of the main things the Empress had us to emphasize in the declarations was the right to nationality. And one of the things I also was trying to push for was making sure that the articles contain an elaboration of our right to self-determination, to determine our own education levels, our own health care, and our own other major institutions that at this time plague so-called black folk in America. Our health is the worst. Our education levels are the worst. Our employment levels are the worst. Those are institutions we need to take charge of and employ ourselves, teach ourselves, and heal ourselves. So part of what we did in going over to Geneva and participating was to help elaborate those articles such that when and if that declaration was ratified by all those nations of the world, it would be of significance to us and help serve not only our purpose, but the purpose of all people, be indigenous or non-indigenous, if that exists, to have an opportunity to exercise our rights. So even one of the most significant things in my life now, after all of the things we did, was to go over there and insert into that declaration those articles on the rights of nationality, which many people still to this day don't understand the concept of nationality. Very significant. The right to self-determination. Very significant. And you can decide whether you want to take a vaccination shot or not. You know, you can decide if you want your child to go to a certain school. There are certain things that people who have distinct cultural differences should be allowed to do. And through the Declaration of Rights for Indigenous People, we're able to have nations to sign on to such a thing. So now when you have a complaint, it's a matter of a civil, instead of being a civil matter, it's now a matter of universal human rights. And now you can call on the world to come and speak for you, which is for me, was a fulfillment of Malcolm X's mission of going to the world and being able to file human rights violation charges against the United States in their mistreatment of people of color. So what we have in that instance is a ratified agreement, nothing more, by all these nations, such that now if something does occur, we now have an international instrument to now refer back to, which we can actually use, if we have to, hypothetically, to bring sanctions against a nation that violates our rights. Because ultimately you'll find many people who are not fully aware of the purpose and the meaning and background of the nation. Understand that nation is nothing more than a workshop for nations to get what they want. And that nation is nothing more than a workshop, actually, of commerce and trade. And when our nations feel the need to do something to a nation, their first and greatest weapon is to embargo trade and cut you out of the trade circle. Limit your trade, limit
right.
your banking, limit your economics. So people think that our nation is a giant military operation trying to conquer the world, and it's nothing more than a workshop and a toy and a tool for powerful nations to achieve their goals under the guise of international cooperation or human rights. And if that's what it's there for, we should at least take advantage of the opportunity to use it under the guise of human rights also, because it's not going away, and it does serve some purpose.
Okay. Well, let me I see I have a caller with a hand raised. I'm going to open up the line and see if they have something to say. Area code 318. Could you tell us who you are, where you're calling from, what's your question or comment? 318.
Greetings. My name is John Hudson. I'm calling from Tallahassee, Florida, but I'm originally born and raised in Monroe, Louisiana. So I feel like, first of all, I want to say that this radio broadcast is really hitting home to me. But my question is for the brother is there anything established in Ouachita right now that I can go and talk to about it? Like, can I contact you and talk to you about is anything established that I can go there? Because, like I said, I'm going to go home sometime this summer, so when I travel there, can I talk to anybody in Monroe, or can I get your contact in Baton Rouge, or I can just network through
yes,
one of y'all?
Yes, sir, brother. I was just in Monroe this past Friday. I go up and taught a class on beginning beekeeping up in Richwood. Actually, in Richwood, across from the school that the Empress started. The Empress started a township in Louisiana called Richwood. It's now called the City of Richwood. As a matter of fact, they won the state basketball championship recently. I was just there in the Empress's town. She founded there. So right now in Monroe, in the Richwood area, there are literally thousands of people there who know about the Empress, were part of her movement years ago, grew up with her, know her, and love her. They're just not out boldly doing it out there. You know, just they're not flamboyant with it. They know the knowledge because we have always been targeted. Okay, our homes, our job security has been targeted because of the people in power, as they call themselves, the dominant culture presently in power, is very uncomfortable with the Ouachita because they know the truth also. Because the city of Monroe actually is on Ouachita property, which is really amazing, and they know it, and I know it, and everybody knows it. But if you say it, you know, there's a big discomfort kicks in. Comfort zones shrink. So when you go back to the area, there are literally I can put you in contact with people who actually lived there. When I was there, lived and worked and took care of her, took care of each other. There are people right there in Richwood who grew up with her, and so yes. But to say all that, there at this time, there is no organized government body in that area that I know of personally that's doing anything. And I will tell you this, when I was up there visiting with some of the elders who were there and out there, they would say, Brother Umar, what happened then ain't going to happen again. We got to move forward and do what she said to do. He basically said, we're not going to relive the past. We're going to complete the mission. A lot of people want to come in and repeat what she did because they missed it. They don't know that the revolution will not be televised. It's not on YouTube, and what we're doing now and here is not on YouTube either, okay? You're not going to see it. If you don't experience firsthand, you don't catch it live, you're going to miss it. That's all. So when you come down here, get my number, get my website. When you get to Monroe, I will turn you on to all kinds of people. There's a university up there and in Richwood and all over the city who can help you out and get you in touch.
Gotcha. I guess I can get your number from Tahaka and we can link from there.
Yeah,
thank you, brother.
Congratulations. Yeah. Okay, thanks, brother.
All right.
Brother Bay, your contact information here is your email is BISMUSEUM. Now, the first four letters, BISM, is in all capital letters. And the remainder museum at AOL.com is how to reach the brother by email. And brother, you want to tell us about your books and give them further ways of contacting you? It's up to you.
Okay, brother. You can reach me. My phone number Is area code 310-916-1551. That's the business line I have. And the email address, as the brother said, is bismuseum@aol.com. Or you can email me at umarbay@washatech.com. That's UMARBEY, umarbay@washatech.com. WASHATECH.com, Washington.
Okay.
Now, the book, we have some books out and some books about to be released this before May 1st. In the Washington, May is New Year's. May is our January. And in May 4th will be the Emperor's born 1927. What's her 83rd birthday? 84? What is it? 83? The Emperor was born on May 4th, 1927. Every year in May, we have giant celebrations. There are so many people in the Washington born in the month of May anyway. And May 1st always be considered the first of the year, May Day in the Washington. So, and out of that, we're going to release several books. I'm going to release a book called The Ancient Ones Revisited in e-book form. We're going to re-release some other information we have and some more information on DVD. So that's all coming. Right now you can go to the website, hotep.org, HOTEP.org, and order on We Are the Washington or Pyramids in America or the DVDs. There are three more DVDs being released once the end of next week. The 21st of April, 22nd of April will be released. And by that time, the e-books will be released. So by May 1st, we'll have out the book, The Ancient Ones Revisited. And the book, The Angel in Revisited, is actually a book we went out and we kind of reviewed the Empress's book. We took her book, The Return of the Ancient Ones, which is difficult to locate, and kind of reviewed it and synthesized out some significant points from the perspective of different members of the Washington who lived and worked with the Empress. So the book the Empress wrote called The Ancient Ones Revisited is in limited supply. Unless there's been a recent reprinting of it, which I doubt, it's in very limited supply. When it was originally printed up back in the early 90s, there was a limited number printed in it. From that point on, I don't think there's ever any more printed from the original plates. They were printed by a brother out of Cleveland. You know, the honorable judge at that time, Judge Clint D. Nelson Bay, and Brother Johnson out of Johnson Bay out of Cleveland, Ohio. First printed that book for the Empress. And now that book is difficult to find, so we're actually going to do a review of that book. And so those who do go find it online, we can kind of guide you to what is significant in that book. There's so many legal documents in there, so much material covered in there. But then it shows you the actual court case where the judge ruled in behalf of the heirs of Henry Turner, the Empress's family, in terms of having land rights above and beyond those of the United States or the state of Louisiana, and recognizing the land grants that were awarded to Marquis de Maison Rouge and to the family of Attorney Turner. So that goes back to another topic. You understand the Empress is the heir to royalty, not only indigenous royalty, but the European royalty that came over here in the form of French noblemen running from the French Revolution, running from the guillotine. They came to so-called Louisiana, to the Washington, and married into the Washington noble family. When you get to Empress's book, there's a section where she has the communication between the French noblemen and the Spanish governor in New Orleans over the Spanish land grant. At that time, Louisiana had been sold back to Spain from France. And if you understand the history of so-called lands called Louisiana today, at one time it was called Florida, West Florida. Florida stretched as far as Houston and up into Oklahoma at one point. And Louisiana and Arkansas were in Mississippi and Florida had nebulous borders. So at that time, there was a Spanish governor named Carondelet in New Orleans who granted land to many French noblemen who were running from the French Revolution. In one of those grants, Marquis de Maison Rouge was told to form 30 French families in the region called the Ouachita Valley. But instead of bringing 30 French families with him, he brought 30 single noblemen. And those 30 single noblemen married the indigenous women in the area and formed 30 what you call today Creole, Cajun, half-black, half-French families here in Louisiana. So beyond the indigenous, colored, black, whatever you call them, people of the Ouachita, there's a whole other lineage of Ouachita who have European French heritage. And that French heritage goes back to the Medici families of Europe, okay? So that in itself is significant in Empress's ability to go and travel to Europe and be recognized. Europeans are well aware of the presence of the ancient mountain-building people. I mean, they're the ones who first reported to the British and to the Americans they got here. So the third Empress of the Ouachita is a wonderful story, and it's yet to be properly brought out. One of the things we're doing is doing a highlight of her. So next month we'll be a very special highlight of the Empress and her accomplishments in honor of her birthday on May 4th. So look for May 1st, look for that to show up on the Moors.com website. Right now you can go to Moors.com and see a little bit on the Empress. But we're going to have more come up by May 1st, by New Year's, or what you call May 1st, on our websites.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Now, I know you you have one book that's already out, We Are the Ouachita, and
yes,
they can get that right there online,
yes,
Amazon.
Go online. If you go online to Amazon.com, it's going to cost you $100. If you go to our website, go to Moors.com or go to Holster.org, you can buy the book for $10.
Okay.
There's still people ordering it for $30, $100 on Amazon, but we still sell it while supplies last, we still sell them for the regular price of $10 a book.
Okay. Now, what about, you want to give us an insight into the new book you're writing?
The new book is actually going to have, it's going to be large, documented, full color, and it's going to be a clearer picture. So there have been so many questions sent in. It's really the response to many people's questions laid out, you know, professionally but very simply. So you can actually see the picture of what's going on, because it's almost like a symphony of information when you connect the different dots of what's going on. And it's going to help people to actually, what I've learned is in sharing the book with people, it just fills in the blanks. There are a lot of blanks in people's understanding of not only world history but their own history, because we all have grandparents or relatives or old uncles or aunts who say these things to us that don't quite make sense about their heritage. Are they grandmama? Are they some African name or some Indian name or some bloodline? So once you get the Empress's story laid out properly, it oftentimes is missing pieces of the puzzle. Myself, having learned about the Empress, was like a giant missing piece to a puzzle from stories I heard from my grandmother and her sister about their heritage, being from Oklahoma, being called Indians but not really being Indians in their own mind, and having to run for their life and losing land that the family owned back in so-called Oklahoma back in the turn of the century. So when I met the Empress, having heard these stories as a little child, it was like a light came on. And I connected her immediately. And you'll find most people on the Empress come from families that have Ouachita heritage in some way. But I speak for myself. But my family, everyone in my family knows our heritage. But I'm the one who sat with Grandma. I'm the one who cares. So in spite of many people in the States being conscious of their heritage, they don't want to deal with it. You spoke earlier about being black, right, and how people don't want to accept the fact black folk was here before, or Moors, or dark people were here before. Understand, I was reading James Baldwin again, one of my classes. I teach a class, and we were reading James Baldwin. And in one of his essays, he talks about why did people do not want to be classified as black? Why did other people, Chinese, Indians, do not want to be classified as black when they come to America? And he goes into a long monologue, but he came out to the conclusion that in America, American culture lacks what older cultures have in terms of having a stratus of classes of people. America is built on people's status, not on their honor, not on their family's nobility, not on honor's legacy, but on status. In this country, status is built on reputation and material possession. And in this culture, mm-hmm. the stereotype of black people and our reputation is negative, and no one wants to be connected with that. And in this culture, quote-unquote, black people are the bottom of the rung. So when you try to connect something great like ancient civilization to black people, there's a disconnect. As the brother said mm-hmm. in his book, The Paleo-American, there's cognitive dissonance. People don't connect. So the great book called The Paleo-American, that's what you get and read also. Another book called The First American, people should get and read. There's so much information out there beyond what I wrote that people should read because it's going to free you up to mm-hmm. really accept and understand that it's okay to be black. It's okay. It's all right. I know I talked to so many Moors who argue with me and say, we ain't black. That's fine. I got a mirror, and I got a consciousness, and I know that what I mean when I say that. I know many people argue in terms of race and nationality, and I'm talking when I say black, I'm not even talking about race nor nationality. I'm talking about a culture, and a culture that anybody can embrace. And I explain to students when they say, what do you mean when you say you're black? And I tell them, you know, there are people in here whiter than me, or whiter than y'all, who are more black than you are. You can go find in any classroom, I was in Canada at school, and say, okay, which one of these white guys in here is black? Oh, he black. So they point to one white guy who's cool and whatever, can dance. So I'm saying, why y'all saying he black? Because his skin is black? No, but because of the culture he chooses to portray and enforce in his daily lifestyle. Not the color of his skin, but the cultural dynamics and traits that he was attracted to and he would cling to and he would boldly demonstrate in his daily lifestyle. So in that case, black was not a matter of the color of skin, but culture. And when we turn to the matter of culture and away from the matter of race, we will begin as a people to regain a sense of self-respect such that we can begin to respect each other. So right now, one of the problems you find, not just the watchdog, but all people, is that there's a lack of connection, a lack of unity, a lack of mutual respect. I mean, and mm-hmm. in this day and age, in this society they call America today, respect is totally gone away. There's no honor. There's no self-dignity. People feel have a license to be the worst bigot and the most negative they choose to be. So it's time for us as a people to stand upon our own ancient culture, one of nobility, one of high, high levels of self-respect and mutual respect, and we can go out and we can dictate our own image from this point forward. Because right now we have been allowed other people to project us in a very negative light. And now mm-hmm. it's time for us to step forward and by our actions, by our behavior, not by some words, not by some threats, but by our very presentation and demonstrate this is what it means to be Washita. And here you find, I mean, years ago, the elder said, Brother Umar, it's a question of branding. How are we going to allow ourselves to be branded? At that time, nobody knew what a Washita was back in 2000, it was the year 2000, matter of fact, 1989, right before Y2K, there was a conference of Washita elders, and they were discussing, how are we going to control the mainstream view of the Washita? And I said, we can't control it. He said, we have to. If we don't define ourselves, others will. And at that point, mm-hmm. at that meeting, he said, we should at least strive to have the Washita portrayed as always being the finest, the best, you know, the Rolex of all people. And I said, wow, this is a deep concept. But I understood what they were saying. They said, because people have for so long taken anything black to be inferior, negative, you know, well, subhuman even at some levels, it was imperative at that time that we took the initiative to begin to have our image defined not by just the extreme people amongst our group. Oftentimes in any group, you only hear about extremists. When amongst the Washita Moors, there are so many great Moorish science temples throughout this land, so many great leaders, so many great people who are members of the Moorish Temple, And I find many of them shying away from their heritage connection to the more scientific because of the image being portrayed by people now under the guise of the Morris Science Temple. Are people calling themselves Moors or Wichita and doing things that are not appropriate in the eyes of the elders of the Wichita or the elders in the Morris Science Temple? So once again, there's a need to have a deliberate effort to keep a very positive image of who we are. And that's only going to come through real life demonstrations. As you saw, you came on, you saw us down here, you came to Baton Rouge, you saw what we were about, okay?
Oh, yeah.
So everyone should be able to go out and just, whatever they do, be great. Be great in what you do. Be godlike. Be great. So mm-hmm. And when you come to Wichita, you find a lot of Wichita people, one of the most common traits you have, if not a physical trait, the color of your skin is not the common trait. What the common trait is a connection to the spiritual world or to the natural world or to the earth. You know, I mean, you find all these Wichitas out here got some kind of spiritual energy, spiritual consciousness that they're aware of, along with a certain amount of humility and sense of service to the Creator that blessed them with that gift. So when you come out here with the Wichita, you can feel, we feel each other. When you came here, could you feel us, brother? Could you feel us?
Say it again now.
When you came and visited with us, you came into our world, into our building, into our home, you could get a sense of feeling, more so than judging us on what you saw. You could judge us on what you felt, is my question to you.
Oh, yeah.
So
well,
in
I feel right at home.
Yeah, see that? Now, understand, some people come here and they're very uncomfortable. You came here and it felt good to you, didn't it? So,
at home. I immediately stopped picking me some plums off the tree because I recognized that tree. And I went around the corner and looked at the gardens and I saw the bees and I was quite fascinated by the bees because I'm looking over there at the plants and the garden and stuff, and I said, well, he got a setup where they could just go right across the street and pollinate, and he got a system going back here. So, yes, I did feel right at home, and inside the museum, I saw books that I had never seen before, and I don't think a whole lot of people know these books even exist. But it was quite an experience, and I really felt comfortable being in Baton Rouge, and I really enjoyed myself. I really did.
We're gonna schedule a conference here. I think it's tentatively set for the weekend of June 28th and 29th. Let me find out for sure. We're planning a conference here at the end of June. And anybody who bought a copy of We Are the Wichita, just bring your book with you, and that should admit you to the conference. Otherwise, I think it's a $25 conference fee. I don't know what they said of that. But right now, the sisters planning a conference down here. In Wichita called the, what they call it, the Wichita Melanin Conference. We talked about that before. It's called the Wichita Melanin Conference at the end of June. So I'm going to get them on that and get it more concrete, get location set, and I'll let you know about that also. But just set your calendar for June 28th, June 29th to be in the Baton Rouge area.
Okay. I'm going to mark that down. June 28th
and 29th.
I got it.
I think it's the weekend.
Okay, I'm sitting here with a copy of this your other book you've written, and the title of this book is called Pyramids in America, A Traveler's Guide. Now, this covers pyramids all over the nation, and with photographs and the name of the state and showing you exactly where they are. And you cover some pyramids in Florida. I didn't even know was down here. I live here.
Oh, yeah. When you said that, like, man, they got to be hundreds of pyramids there, and just, you know, a few dozen I can name, but there are hundreds. I mean, your state, I mean, Marco Island, one of the oldest pyramids in the nation. I know it's 4,000 years old. Over by Tampa, Miami, Jacksonville, you name it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Go ahead, forgive me. Go ahead, excuse me.
I was going to take a but hold on. I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we can take up where we left off at. So just just a second.
Go. Montezuma, the Aztecs, the Toltecs, all these cultures who were present when the first Europeans arrived in the 1500s. Understand these great civilizations, Toltecs and the Incas and the Mayans, are remnants of a culture of people that were here 5,000-6,000 years before the Europeans arrived. A race of ancient dark-skinned people, dare say African black people, but sure not the people we see occupying these areas today. So when you talk about this once again, it would take literally years of teaching to cover the information. So, I mean, I digress once again, brother. Please ask another question.
Okay. All right. Now, in your opinion, who would you say is the rightful owner of the Americas?
You say rightful owner? You're talking about a people, a nation, a god? Who would be owning
the
land?
What peoples are the rightful owners of America? The Americas.
Obviously, the indigenous people are the rightful owners of any land, be it the Americas, be it Australia, be it some island in Hawaii. The indigenous people, the original people what they call the original inhabitants, are the proprietors of the land. People who have, you know, continuous occupation. So the indigenous people are. The question is, who are indigenous people? Not just who are indigenous people recognized by the occupying government, because you will find that many of the so-called native people who've never surrendered the rights to their land were never recognized. The government won't recognize them. Washita people will not recognize the tribe, because if you understand the history of the Washita people, as soon as the Americans quit fighting in themselves in the Civil War, as soon as the Northerners and Southerners quit fighting each other, they went right back to fighting the Washita. And when the Civil War ended in 1865, by 1867, they were off fighting the next battle known as the Battle of the Washita, where they took all those American generals, sent them out west, and started slaughtering Native people who refused to give up their land and go to the reservations. When you go study the history of Colonel Custer, before he became General Custer and Sheridan, you'll find that they went back in the 1860s, went into what they call Indian Territory, where they had displaced all those Native peoples during the Trail of Tears, into what they call Oklahoma or the Indian Territory. And they went there in the 1860s to hunt down the last of the Native people who refused to give up their land and go to reservations. And, of course, who were they? The Washita under Chief Black Kettle. They call the Cheyenne or the Shoshones and other tribes, other names they use to divide our people. Once again, these people were aware. They had to run from the European invasion, the American invasion to the land, and ended up at the very head of the Washita River, where they were slaughtered along the banks of the Washita River in what they call today Oklahoma. So the Washita people have a history and a legacy and a heritage that can be easily traced throughout history, well documented. You will find evidence of our people.
Okay. All right. Well, I also want to mention something else. Matter of fact, let me get it. And I was exposed to that while I was there, and I've just gotten mine recently, and I wanted you to elaborate on that, if you would. You just hold on 1 second. Let me pull this out of here. And I got it. I have gotten a bottle of Pro EM-1. And my question is, what is EM-1 technology?
Oh, okay. You said effective microorganisms. Effective microorganism technology is technology that was been around for the beginning of time, 1,000 years, using bacteria and positive bacteria to do stuff, but it's actually technology was developed in the early 80s in Japan by a Dr. Tetsuo Higa. He actually patented it and trademarked this concept called effective microorganisms. Today, people term it as probiotics. But it's used not only in the human body as a source of positive bacteria for your stomach. It's used in all type of environments of living organisms. And we use it in many areas. It's just to fight odor around the house, to clean, keep the house clean in a natural, non-chemical way. There's some uses for EM technology. But what you have there, you can use as a probiotic. You can drink it every day, put it in your stomach, and then put the good bacteria in there. And an example of that is oftentimes people get an infection, and they have to go get some antibiotics, penicillin, and take it. I know one time I had to get my teeth pulled, and I, who am totally anti-drugs, was forced to get an antibiotic and take this antibiotic for, she told me, for 10 days, take this pill 3 times a day. And when I finished, because I had such a bad tooth in my mouth that rotted, she said, when you finish taking the antibiotics for 10 days, come in and I can pull your tooth out. Right now it's too infected, so I take antibiotics. When I finished antibiotics, she told me to go get some yogurt or drink some acidophilus to restore the good bacteria in my digestive tract, my gastrointestinal tract, right? EM is that good bacteria in a more natural, non-dairy, non-animal form. It is effective microorganisms that go in your body and clean your system up. They'll clean out your colon. I've heard so many stories from different people and what it's done for their health conditions, and I make no medical claims. I speak from personal testimony people give me in terms of them helping with their prostate problems, sleep problems, inflammation problems, different issues have been addressed. Simply by correcting infective bacteria or just imbalance, chemical imbalance, biological imbalance within the body using effective microorganisms to balance your internal environment as well as around the house. I mean, if I have an animal, you can spray the animals with it, it'll kill the odor. We actually learned about the EM first going out in Arizona and dealing with Native American farmers out there and other people who farmed in areas that were had water shortages. And one of the things they used was EM to help increase the yield of their crop. And there were also organic and non-chemical farming operations, agricultural establishments. And everywhere we went throughout California and Arizona, people were using effective microorganisms or some form of that EM technology was being used in different places. And ultimately, I ended up meeting with the U.S.-based company here out in Arizona. Then I went and visited the local manufacturing plant in Texas run by a great man named Mr. Dwayne King over in Alto, Texas. He actually is a chicken rancher. And on this chicken ranch, which is so, if you've been to a chicken ranch before, a chicken ranch does not smell good. And this gentleman had a chicken ranch that had no odor whatsoever. And we're talking about tens of thousands of chickens in chicken houses that were just so far you couldn't see the end of them. And he treated his chickens with this EM technology, no chemicals, no disease, just amazing. And he himself being a chicken farmer and understanding how in rural agriculture areas, odor is a very big problem. You're talking about cattle ranches, horse ranches, in swine ranches, whatever, animal farms and farms in general. Odor is one major problem, and the EM is very effective. If you simply have a dog or cat in your home, you need to get some EM and spray in there. If your children miss the toilet, you need to spray some EM around your toilet, okay? Anywhere you might have these foul odors occur, EM is very effective in cleaning my kitchen. And whenever I do my drains, I put EM all through my house, you know, on a regular basis. I spray the room with it because it is a natural disinfectant in any environment.
Well, now the bottle that I have is the Pro EM-1 Daily Probiotic Cleanse.
Yeah, probiotic. So the company called Terraganics is the U.S. distributor of EM products. And one of the products they have that's been out for years is a probiotic. And recently I've seen other companies try to copy it. But the probiotic is a great product. They have another one called EMX Gold. They have different concentrations of the technology used for different applications. Some are industrial agriculture. Some are just for around the house gardening. So there's a whole I won't say subculture. There's a whole network of information on EM technology outside this country, around the world, where they don't have access to all these chemicals we have in this land. Most people will use a natural, inexpensive remedy like EM in place of many of the chemicals and toxins we use in this land. If people in this country learn more about EM, it will solve a lot of problems in municipal water systems and other places where cell technology has left many areas, especially around sewer plant treatment plants. Many of those plants are built in so-called minority or black communities, okay? And those areas often suffer with disease and other ailments because they suffer from the release of hydrogen sulfide gas and other toxins from the facilities. And also refineries and other big industries release these toxins. And the technologies EM has would greatly reduce that toxic release into the air, affecting those fence line neighbors to those facilities. So down here in the Washington, we have a company set up called Washington Technology, where we do research and consulting on that level. And we've done a lot of research at EM, and the company there has worked with us, and we hope at one point we help them secure contracts down here in Louisiana where we can bring this EM technology into use right here. Right now we're being confronted with one of these corporate giants trying to block the implementation of this product, and they've actually committed types of fraud, scientific fraud, in trying to prevent us from getting in. But very soon, this month, we're going to come in and ask the city to come in and deal with their fraud and allow us to come and help solve the problems of the people here in East Baton Rouge Parish who suffer from the debilitating illnesses that are caused by hydrogen sulfide gas. So one of the goals of the Washita people here in the East Baton Rouge area, down in Lower Louisiana, what we call the Lower Doug Demonia, is to address healing the land. We can heal the land first by healing the water. And once we can show that we've already proven that the technology works, right now our only battle is with what we call the industrial military complex and traditional industry trying to hold on to failed technology that doesn't work. At this point, our area is so desperate in solving the problem, we believe it's just a matter of time before water technology gets justice, and the city of Baton Rouge and its interim director, Mr. David Guillory, is going to have his consultants correct their felonious report and allow the city to buy the product and implement applications of it and solve the problem of people here in North Baton Rouge. They have a community here, their plant, and the people there are actually being bought out of their homes, you know, at sub-market value instead of correcting the problem. And it's really sad to see people lose their homesteads because you have corporations who put their profits ahead of the lives of people. And we hope we can hopefully prevent those people from losing their homes and being forced to move out. So that's one of the projects we work on the Washita. That's a project to help heal this land down here. It was what the Washita returned to. We would return to heal the land. We're not here to take the land from anybody. It already belongs to God himself. So who the land belongs to? It belongs to the people on the land. And what has occurred down here is that we have been given grace, and we have, in our demonstration, have shown ourselves at least worthy of being talked to. There was a time when local governments and national governments wouldn't even recognize Washita people. And in spite of the negative propaganda that's often being broadcast against us, we are able to hold our heads high and present a noble presentation to the city when we talk to them, and we have their attention and their respect, and we hope we can continue to build on the relationship and actually be allowed to come and help solve those problems on a large-scale level, and not only solve the problems here in East Baton Rouge, but go around the nation and be able to go in and introduce a green technology that not only can solve the problems that have been plaguing people for years, but also create new job, new industry, whole new technologies. And you can bring in some young people and train them. So there's opportunity that we're looking at beyond just ourselves, but in terms of trying to rebuild the nation. Because as we try to build the Washington Nation and develop our nationality, One thing I saw in my reading again with James Baldwin and listening to the great Dr. Naeem Akbar was that the fact that we are all inextricably tied together. So there's no way we're going to separate in the fate of the Ouachita, the fate of Mexican Americans, white Americans, you know, rednecks, Negroes, call them people as you want to, the bottom as you want to, we all will share the same fate. So we can allow these so-called Republicans and Democrats or whatever divisive groups spring up to try to dominate. But when you understand the majority of people, because, brother, I'm a Ouachita, so we can't vote. And I was just shocked to see Obama actually win the race again. Many of the Ouachitas just didn't believe that the nation had overcome its severe racism to allow Obama to win again. And when they did, it was a signal to many elders. You know, people in their 80s and 90 years old are in shock. They're Ouachita down here in their 90s, and they just cannot believe Obama is really the president. They don't believe that. If you were alive in the 1940s and 50s, there's no way you're going to accept the fact that Obama's the president. And to hear them speak about it and the significance to an elder who lived through the racism of the 40s and 30s and 40s and 50s, to hear their perspective on Obama's presidency and his reelection, to me is comforting because it lets me know that there really has been a change. Even though I may be from a generation that can't appreciate what they suffered, I do appreciate their recognition of the change in American society, and now they say it's simply on us to have the courage to demand justice be maintained and not fear this false illusion of the majority, because the real majority is not a number. The real majority is a matter of influence. And in this day and age, with the internet and the information system in place, we can now wield our influence over all those negative forces that are in place. And that is the beauty of this year. As you know, brother, for the past few years, you've not heard me speak at all. I don't go out. When you go to YouTube and see all these clips, you will find, other than the clips that we put up ourselves on Pyramid in America, 90% of the clips that feature our videos are bootleg clips other people took from DVDs they bought from us and extracted parts of our DVD and included in some of their other work. I mean, I've seen YouTube clips that feature parts of our DVDs in conjunction with other information that is not something that we personally agree with. So when you see some of the stuff on the internet, some people assume it's our work, and it may be us on the video, but other people taking our videos and manipulating them to distort the picture, taking what we say out of context. But ultimately, when you get the whole video or the whole thing, you will see the true context in which things are given. So with that said, brother, do you have any more questions?
Well, actually, no, brother. You told me that you've given me a couple of hours, and we have 35 more minutes. I would, if there's anything else that you think that is important for us to know in regards to the subject matter, if there's anything else that I might have missed when I was down there, because y'all had so much going on and we was in a hurry to get to a meeting, and I didn't get a chance to stay as long as I would have, but I would like to just sit down in that museum and just get all them books and just somehow go to reading.
Well, brother, that's what it's here for, brother. This, what you came to was called the Endita Mortar Institute, and the books you saw are part of a collection we call the Truthberry. So when children can't find it in the library, they'll come to the Truthberry, and they'll come, we call the Truthberry tree, come here and sit under the tree and just soak the knowledge, the tree of knowledge. So that's here. And anyone come out here, we find that just as you arrive, every week, if not almost every day, someone else is passing through the area will stop by here and just, you know, they find us. So we're here, we're accessible, we're available, and you can find us any time. But I would like to say before we go is that it's very important that all the people out there who are being newly introduced to the idea of the Ouachita or Moors or Moorish history be very careful as you go forth, because there are people who may deliberately or accidentally mislead you. And don't take that one negative experience as the sum total of what it is to be a watchtower being Moore. There's a lot. One thing to say about the Moore Science Temple is that there's no homogenous, monotonous image or characteristic of the Moore Science Temple. There are so many different kind of Moors out there. It's amazing. Even in one city, you may find up to 10 temples in one city of people with different ideology. But they all themselves consider themselves to be Moors. It's sort of like analogous to Christianity. Well, in the city of Christians, you have all these Christians who are Baptists, Methodists, Catholic, Jehovah's Witness, and they all consider themselves to be Christians, but they all have distinct differences. The Moore Science Temple is similar in that you have Moors, and some Moors are deep into Islam. Some Moors are Hebrew Israelites. Some Moors are Southern Baptist Christians. And some Moors are Methodists. So the Moore Science Temple cannot be defined as any one group, and it shouldn't be, but it should be able to come together under some commonalities in spite of any whatever political, religious differences. There's a unifying concept of nationality that should rally us. As you know, as Naeem Akbar taught, he said when you talk about our Jewish brothers and sisters, they some of them don't like each other. I mean, Hasidic Jews and American Jews and certain Orthodox Jews have conflicts we never know about, because when it comes time to being Jewish, they are united. They show a united front in spite of their differences behind. They keep all that stuff behind closed doors, keep it in-house. A lot of people need to learn to take our differences, as Malcolm said, and handle them in shop talk, handle them behind closed doors, and keep a united front. So Dr. Ben always said he would never argue with his elders or contemporaries in public, even disagree with them in private, never publicly show a force of disunity. And our people seem to sometimes take pride in coming in and displaying their lack of unity or lack of agreement. They want to come make a public display, and I've been to several events where someone took the opportunity to get on the microphone and make it into a negative event and show their opposition in an event. So our people need to learn the power of unity, or at least the power of silence, and the power of being on time, in the moment, and timing is essential. So, brothers and sisters, as you go out there and you learn more and you study more, do not be afraid to ask questions. In order to gain your nationality, doesn't cost you a dime. If someone's trying to sell your nationality, then you should really examine it. There's nothing wrong with joining a national organization. I am Black nationalist, always have been, always will be. But to be part of the Washington Nation is not something you can go fill an application and buy a membership card too. It's a heritage. It's a lineage you would have. And the good thing is most people can trace their roots, be they having part Irish, part African, part Asian. I mean, I've met Washingtons who are poor, who are from part Korean and part Washington. How do you argue with them? I met Washingtons who were white as snow, rednecks. Turners, I love them. They're Washington. So that is the true nature of being a Washington Moor. They come in all races. But the Moor Science Temple is primarily people who at one point have been classified as Negro, Black, African American, Ethiopian, and no longer want to be classified as that. We call ourselves Moors, M-O-R, based on the teaching of one prophet, Noble Dwali. So anyone can join the Moore Science Temple who goes through the course, studies, and so desires to. Moore Science Temple appears in several forms, several different ideologies, but there's a lot of unifying factors that can be a bridge to bring together very, very great people. There's some very great temples around the nation, and there are also some temples or supposed temples doing things that I personally do not like. And I'm not here to call any names, but you know who you are, and it's not a positive thing for the collective. So there are people out there who I would even categorized as cultural pimps doing things that are detrimental long term. Brother, you yourself, if you go back and look, recently there was an article on the NPR news radio station, shocked me, talking about the Moorish Science pimp. And it just, once again, never attempted to give any positive light on the true greater nature of the Moorish Science temple, and only chose to speak about a few Moors doing some hideous things. Okay.
Okay.
So once again, we need to take control and take license of that article and respond to it, and make sure that other Moors aren't penalized in the future due to the negative image projected on that international radio show. Okay, because it was not probably talked about Moors not wanting to pay taxes, not wanting to obey the law, and I'm sure there's some Moors out there who feel that way, but all Moors do not have that ideology. All Moors don't feel that way, but their story made it seem like anybody who claimed to be a Moor was anti-government, and understanding all that comes from ideology that actually was born out of white nationalist movements in the 90s, those early patriot groups and freedom movers, or what do they call them? They call those people in the 90s, the ones who took claim for bombing the Oklahoma building and setting off bombs in the Olympics.
Oh, you're talking about the, freedom...
The freedom people, like the ones, the Montana Freeman militias, there you go. Patriot militia groups. Those militia groups had ideology where they suddenly were trying to be free. When Ronald Reagan and George Bush lost office and Bill Clinton came in office, there were a group of white Americans who did not want to be part of America anymore. If you remember in the 90s, they became very anti-government, anti-federal government groups showed up all the time, talking all kind of talks. Do you remember the Montana Freeman and other groups, Ruby Ridge, these organizations who went out and did things in the name of being anti-American government. And they formed these groups. They were nothing more than offshoots of other white nationalists and white supremacists and other hate groups coming together under the guise of not being American citizens, not having to pay taxes, not having to have driver's license, right to drive things. And all that is very good, but there are people who have distorted that in some way. Now, all Moors have those same rights that those white nationals are trying to claim, but we don't have to go through the same procedure they had to go through. So those rights are ours inherently, but there are a lot of people out there who come to their knowledge of their heritage, Moors heritage, but they're coming to it from the perspective of, I'm looking for not a solution or salvation, but I'm running from some type of problem I'm having. I'm running from damnation rather than moving towards salvation. So Udra Lee symbolized his work as carrying a woman to salvation, and that is our legacy, to help bring our people to salvation. So it is important that we collectively understand that we are to help each other out in every way. And those brothers and sisters who are out there hurting each other need to take note of it and police themselves. And let's build. And so when people come into the knowledge for the first time, their first impression is not one of a negative experience. They're not being exploited or being misled. Let's make sure that when people come into the knowledge of Moore's history, Moore's legacy, Moore's science, it's a positive experience for them.
I have to agree 100%, brother. I spend my entire days every day, 7 days a week, doing the same thing, and in touch with brothers all across the United States, regardless.
But you're on the right track, brother. You're on the right track. But once again, you are very thoughtful. You are very. You have good intentions. From my view, you have good intentions. Some people have only one intention, which is to line their pocket. Understand? They have no national consciousness, no cultural consciousness. They have one objective, and if they can sell you, pencils or whatever they can do to survive and get over, they will do that. Mm-hmm. That is not where you come from. You have a very sincere intention. You have a very sincere motivation in what you do. So I commend you and can carry on, brother.
I certainly appreciate it, my brother. Well, brother, that's all of the questions I have. I have a few plugs set up here from your YouTube plugs, and I also have a segment on the ancient Kemetans. And I know we have the Moabite, ancient Moabite tribe and ancient Kemetan tribes. And I know there's a tremendous amount of information in the Americas on the ancient Kemetans and their artifacts and hieroglyphics and all of this stuff here. And you care to elaborate on that? Or are you running out of time? Or?
Okay, brother. The ancient Kemetans, that is a whole other show right there. But let's talk about the actual evidence that ancient people commit in so-called North America. And you always first would go to the Grand Canyon. And the Grand Canyon is quietly being taught about in terms of its ancient history. And relatively, we found it over 100 years ago. And then over 100 years ago, there were artifacts found in the Grand Canyon that could indicate the presence of ancient Kemetic people, Egyptians, if you must, that not only people from Egypt, people from India, China. There was a hieroglyphic text found not only inside the Grand Canyon, but on rocks above the Grand Canyon. And I, having written about that years ago, was able to attract the attention of people who actually went in and saw firsthand what we wrote about. So I was able to go out to Arizona and meet with different people who in the 40s were inside the Grand Canyon digging up relics. And they talked about finding rooms full of these, what they call color boys, bodies of mummified black men, over 7 feet tall in the Grand Canyon, along with hundreds of rooms of artifacts. They included gold, copper, cooking utensils, weapons, furnishing, and different, I would call artifacts of images of men and women, some in pornographic positions that were found in the Grand Canyon carved out of gold, silver. And the gentleman I spoke to, who just passed this winter, I won't tell his name, talked about going in to find this stuff. So many years we talked to him about that. You know, he not only knew about the Grand Canyon, he himself is Washita, in that he is part Cherokee coming from Ross Landing over near what they call Chattanooga. So when he heard about the Washita, he's like, okay, I'm Washita. He used some information. He came down, met with the Empress. He brought the Empress several copper artifacts and model artwork out of what he called the Black Indians of Arizona. This gentleman talked about the black Apaches versus the white Apaches, and him growing up in Arizona in the time when they be shooting those John Wayne movies out the Red River, and him being around to see. And he also got to grow up with the so-called Indians, Native Americans, in Arizona. So that the Egyptians in the Grand Canyon in America is a well-known fact. There are many books, one by a man named a gentleman from Ancient American magazine, Mays Frank. That name, Frank Mays, Ancient American Man, Joseph.
Strebel. He did a tremendous amount of information on it.
There's so many writings on the ancient people in North America. But personally, I'm a researcher, so I go out and I can talk about books I read about it. You're going to find somebody who actually was there. You go meet with the people who actually went inside, and you get their live accounts, get their photographs from what they found, actually get artifacts from them. So even you talk about something called the Burroughs Cave up in what they call Illinois. They're throwing stuff, trying to say that Burroughs Caves is something that was a fake. Somebody made these fake heads up, and they try to discount them, disregard them, and get rid of them out of any discussion about the presence of black people or Africans in the Americas. Yet anyone who examines these stones, these carvings, and I personally have held in my hand and seen them, knows that it's impossible for anybody in this day and age to have fabricated all those stones. You would have to have been a linguistics expert, a cultural expert from many different cultures to have fabricated all those stones. And it's just incredible. When you have to find 40 different experts to validate them, there'll probably take 40 different people to even try to create them. So there are so many artifacts that have quickly been discounted, conveniently discounted by so-called Western historians and scientists that can easily demonstrate the presence of our people here beyond just the time of what they call Egypt. We're talking about millions of years. We're talking about before the recording of time in this millennia, in this eon of time. There were people here long before what we were given as history. When you talk about the history of the world beginning at the time of Adam and Eve, and Adam and Eve being estimated between 6,000 and 7,000 years ago, the first appearance of Adam and Eve in this Garden of Eden. Understand that there are people here in so-called Louisiana thousands of years before the story of Adam and Eve. And that is so significant when I speak to ministers here. When they try to internalize the idea, it causes a sometimes pain in their faces, and they're like, "What? You can verify the presence of black folk in Louisiana before Adam and Eve? Oh, you can't tell that to my congregation. They're not trying to hear that. This is not something even accepted, even by myself initially. Like, wow, what? That's impossible. So, once again, cognitive dissonance. Go check out the book called The Paleo-American, Cognitive Dissonance. And I think it's in the foreword, in the opening of it. Okay, but at this time, I have to get back in here and finish getting the sunny out of this cold. I got to fix my machine here and get back to work here. But it's been a pleasure speaking to you, but I look forward to seeing you again, too, okay?
Oh, I'll be back. Ain't no problem.
Oh, I know.
I will be back. I'm going to come back a day in advance. So I can get out there with y'all and spend a little time, man. I will be back, though. I certainly appreciate you being on, brother. It's been a pleasure. And I will be contacting you.
Thank you, brother. It's been an honor to be on your show with you. I thank the elders for allowing me to exist and speak. I thank Almighty God Allah. And anybody out there who wants to learn more about Ouachita, stay tuned to this show. And you can reach us at moors.com. MUURS, moors.com, or hotep.org.
Okay. All right. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, brother, for being on.
Thank you, brother. One blessed love. One blessed love.
Peace. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we have 1 hour and 17 minutes left, and we still want to continue bringing very, very important information on. And we just finished listening to our brother R.A.U.M.A.S. Bay, author of the book Pyramids in America, and the other book, We Are the Ouachitani. Soon we'll be having a new book come out, and so y'all pay very, very close attention and to what's going on. And this evening we did a tremendous amount of information on the Ouachita, but now we want to go over and do a little bit more in-depth and see what we can find out about those ancient Kemetans of what we are calling the Egyptians today. So you all hold your hat.
On Monday, April 5th, 1909, in the Phoenix Gazette, an incredible story, an article that would blow your mind. In a moment, we're going to be talking with David Hatcher Childress about this and some other stories. He is a well-known author, of course, The Mystery of the Olmecs, Technology of the Gods, Lost Cities of North and Central America. What a story we have in store for you next on Coast to Coast AM. David Hatcher Childress, known as the real-life Indiana Jones to many of his fans, he has traveled the world several times over seeking adventure and the answers to the mysteries of mankind's past. In 1976, David left the United States on what would become a 6-year research and adventure odyssey. During the time, he first studied firsthand the ancient civilizations of Africa, the Middle East, China, sometimes journeying into very dangerous territory along the way. And David, of course, has a wide scope of interest, as you will find out tonight, not only on ancient civilizations and technology, but also free energy, anti-gravity, and UFOs. And he's been just investigating these subjects for well over 20 years. David Hatcher Childress. Hey, David, welcome back. How are you?
Hi, good, George. It's good to be back on your show.
It's been a long time, hasn't it?
You know, it's been a few years, and in that time, well, I've been traveling around the world and working on new books.
Getting new data for us.
Yes, yes, indeed. And, you know, this whole thing of the Egyptian city and the Grand Canyon is one of those popular subjects that just, you know, won't go away. And it's an interesting one to discuss. It will actually be a chapter or two in an upcoming book that I'm working on that should be out next spring, which is a book called Lost Cities and Ancient Mysteries of the Southwest.
Excellent. Because you, in your book, The Lost Cities of North and Central America, also, you made reference to the Phoenix Gazette article. Let's talk about that for a moment. It came out in 1909. What was that?
You know that it was a front page newspaper story in the 1909 Phoenix Gazette. Phoenix was a young city then. And what they reported was really astonishing. I mean, they reported that the Smithsonian Institution was doing excavations in the Grand Canyon. They said that it was being supervised by an archaeologist named Jordan. It all had to do with another explorer named Kincaid, who had been traveling down the Grand Canyon. And what he claimed he discovered was these caverns inside the Grand Canyon. Inside these caverns were, he thought, and then the Egyptian, the Smithsonian, then later confirmed, according to the newspaper report, that there were Egyptian artifacts, there were Hindu, Buddhist artifacts from India. They were saying that, you know, there were mummies in there. They were saying this was going to totally change the history of America and the Southwest. Egyptians and Hindus and Buddhists were coming across the Pacific and the Atlantic, coming to North America. They were involved in the civilizations here, and that apparently they had a special vault in the Grand Canyon where they buried some of the leaders, the people they had left behind with artifacts and things like that, and that the Smithsonian Institution got involved. They were hauling all this stuff out of these caves, including these mummies, swords, shields, statues.
Jeez.
Right, and then this the Jordan, the archaeologist, he was going back to Washington, D.C., back to the Smithsonian, and I mean, this is these exciting new discoveries in the Grand Canyon. There was one follow-up story, and then no one really ever heard of it again. And it's really a lot like the first Indiana Jones movie, where Indiana Jones has discovered the lost Ark of the Covenant, and then he, right at the end of the movie, he says, "Well, you know, where's the Ark?" And they tell him, "Oh, well, don't worry, you know, top men are working on it." And then the last scene in the movie is this giant warehouse, apparently at the Smithsonian. And the Ark of the Covenant is in this crate, and it's being put in this giant warehouse, and no one's ever going to see it again.
Put away, yeah.
And that's kind of what appears to have happened with these artifacts in the Grand Canyon. So,
well, first of all, do you think the article was real? It wasn't a joke, wasn't a hoax, right?
Well, you know, back in those days, there were a lot of hoax newspaper articles, and you know, as a researcher, I'm constantly looking for and digging up old newspaper articles and stories about giants, unusual archaeological finds, weird things like that. And when you look at this one, especially because of the detail, it's naming people, later I was able to verify some of it. And I would say, yes, I mean, this does seem to be a true story. And the more and more I've looked into it over the years, I first wrote about it in my book, Lost Cities of North and Central America, and that came out in 1994. And in those years, I've had a number of letters. People have called me occasionally, trying to give me, you know, different leads and things like that. And in the end, what I've concluded is that, yes, there really is something to this.
Did anybody ever find this Kincaid fellow who was the explorer?
You know, this was all turn of the century. He was, the article is in 1909. He was doing this in, say, 1906 that he went down. I mean, it all took like years and stuff for these things to come out. Yeah, no one ever really discovered this Kincaid fellow. And in fact, Jordan, the archaeologist, he seems to have vanished too. Although, as we've gone through old records of the Smithsonian, there is a guy who's mentioned named Jordan a few times. It's likely that he disappeared too.
It's weird.
Well, it's quite a strange thing. And then as I started looking into the Smithsonian and the idea of cover-ups, people naturally ask me when this subject comes up, they're like, well, why would they cover something like that up anyway? And that is a good question, and you know, there are answers for that. Part of the whole thing of the Southwest and what was going on here, even right now, I'm in Arizona talking to you. There's a lot of the history here is just so discombobulated. The idea of mummies that were found in the Grand Canyon. Mainstream archaeologists maintain even today that Native Americans here in New Mexico, Colorado, Arizona, Utah, whatnot, that they didn't mummify the dead. And yet the Grand Canyon article is talking about mummies and things like that in these caverns. So that itself was a clue. Are there mummies out here? And one of the things that I found out that was pretty strange, too, was that the quintessential roadside attraction out in the desert, it's in southern Arizona near Tombstone, near Benson, and it's called The Thing. And as you're driving through the desert, you start seeing the billboards, 100 miles to The Thing. What is The Thing? Next exit, The Thing. And so eventually you get your parents to pull off and take you to The Thing at this gas station. And I've been to The Thing a couple of times. And it's,
what is
you
the
can
thing?
Still see it, actually.
What is it?
What is it? Yeah, when you go there, you pay $1, and you get to go in and see The Thing. And what The Thing is a mummy of a woman and child together. And they're mummified. And supposedly, this mother and child mummy, that is, they call The Thing, is from the Grand Canyon. And I've... trying to trace it, The Thing, is very tricky. What little information I've gotten is that it was purchased privately, also around 1910 or so. It came out of Flagstaff, Arizona, which is near to the Grand Canyon. And apparently The Thing may well be one of the artifacts, one of the mummies that came out of these caves, rock-cut caves in the Grand Canyon.
There were also apparently tablets of stone with hieroglyphs written all over it that the Smithsonian folks took.
That's right, and we don't know what hieroglyphs that would have been, Egyptian, presumably. They don't describe them. There's no photos. We don't. That's one of the things that I've really searched for, old photos, objects. I mean, I've found The Thing. There's an interesting story of a guy who, his name was Seth Tanner. And Seth Tanner was a Mormon guy who came down from Utah in the late 1800s. He had to flee Utah, essentially. He was a wanted man. He had been part of this famous Mormon massacre in Utah. As federal troops went into Utah, he fled into the Grand Canyon, as did a number of Mormon pioneers who the law was after. And what a lot of these guys did was they went into the Grand Canyon, particularly the northern area, and they prospected. They created, one guy created a ferry, Lee's Ferry. They went up many old trails and things like that. And this guy, Seth Tanner, in fact, a lot of things in the Grand Canyon are named after this guy. There's a Tanner Trail. There's Tanner Wash. There's a Tanner Canyon. Particularly up in northern Arizona And around the Navajo Indian Reservation, which does include part of the Grand Canyon, this guy is really famous. And a weird thing happened to him. I was able to find a photograph of him from the late 1800s. He, according to the stories, and it's hard to find information, but I've been poring over old books on the Grand Canyon and stuff. This guy did a lot of prospecting in really remote areas of the Grand Canyon, and the area that I identified a lot where these things were going on was where the Little Colorado meets the Grand Canyon, and that is its own canyon in itself, the Little Colorado Canyon. This guy, Seth Tanner, at some point, he went into some kind of a cave, and the Hopi Indians caught him there. And he was in some sacred place, some forbidden secret spot that no one was allowed to see. But he thought. Now, normally they would have killed him, except he had several wives, and one of his wives was a Hopi Indian. So instead of killing him, they blinded him, and they threw some kind of a acid or something in his face, and he became blind. And that was, for them, that was good enough. And he spent the rest of his life as a blind old man in various villages around the Grand Canyon. They would, children and other people would have to lead him around and feed him. And there were some photos taken of him. And you can see him. He's got his eyes open. He clearly is blind. And he's a bushy old prospector guy. His name was Seth Tanner. And from what I can tell, what happened was he... And this was before the 1909 article in the Phoenix Gazette. Yeah, he had stumbled into these secret caves in the Grand Canyon, and would have been killed, except he was blinded. I've also found that there's a couple of movies that are basically also based on this story. One is the great Gregory Peck Western called McKenna's Gold. And that movie, and in my mind, that's a great Western. That movie, too, is about this secret city in the Grand Canyon. There's mining is involved. One of the things that's in this area, too, is a special Hopi salt mine. That mine is off limits today, and certain Hopi elders are allowed to go down into the Grand Canyon to this salt mine. But other visitors are not allowed into that area. And in my mind, this seems to be around the area where Seth Tanner was doing his prospecting, where he found some cave, where he was blinded. And it seems to be also the place that the 1909 Phoenix Gazette article was talking about.
You know, Hopi legend also talks about ancestors to the Hopis once living in an underground world in the Grand Canyon. And that could also explain some of this stuff.
Well, that's right. I mean, as you start to look into this whole thing, there's an Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon. It also has to do, apparently, with Hindus and Buddhists coming from ancient India and stuff like that. And the Hopi Indians are absolutely part of it. Their own legends of their own origin, like as you're saying, is that they lived underground in the Grand Canyon with the ant people. And this was during, the Hopis also have the same kind of mythology as the Aztecs and the Mayans, and the Olmecs had this too, where the world has been destroyed many times in the past, four or five times, and we're living in either the fourth or the fifth world, depending on the Aztec or Mayan. And the Hopis have that too. So during these periodic destructions and cataclysms, the Hopi at one point went underground, lived in deep beneath the earth in the Grand Canyon somewhere, and they lived with these ant people, they said, and then they emerged, you know, after the cataclysms were over and the new world was born. They emerged from a hole in the Grand Canyon, a place called the Sipapu, and that's a place in the Grand Canyon you can also you can find some photographs of it. It's near to the Hopi salt mines. It's near to where all these things are named after this Tanner guy. And it is like a hole in the ground. You're not allowed to go there either. And this is something else you'll find, as I did. We started researching this. There's a lot of places in the Grand Canyon that are off limits. It's highly controlled.
Yeah, okay.
Gets a lot of visitors, too, every year. But, you know, if you want to go hiking the Grand Canyon and go places, you have to apply in advance. There's a number of areas that are utterly off limits. And weird secret places. There's another strange thing about the Grand Canyon. If you look at a map of the Grand Canyon and all of the many different formations, they've given them names. But they've given them these Egyptian and Hindu and Buddhist names.
Isn't that incredible?
Shiva Temple, Temple of Cheops, Osiris Temple, Buddha Temple, things like that. So that was kind of strange right there, too, that for some unknown reason, perhaps just coincidence, so much stuff in the Grand Canyon has all these Egyptian and Hindu Buddhist.
Who gave them those names, David?
Well, again, early prospectors and things like that. And, you know, some of the formations in the Grand Canyon, like the Cheops Pyramid, they look like, you know, pyramids from a distance. So they're given those names. But there's just such a plethora of these names all through the Grand Canyon and linked to that. You know, a curious thing, too, with so many of the Indian tribes around here, the Hopis, the Zunis, you have the different Pueblo Indians. The Zunis are who live also near the Grand Canyon, but they live near Gallup, right along the Arizona-New Mexico border, although part of the Zuni reservation is in Arizona. But some years ago, University of Oregon anthropologist wrote a book about the Zunis, and in her study, she found that the Zunis were speaking ancient Japanese. How about that?
Jeez.
And in fact, if you go to Zuni, I was just there recently, and she talks about this in her book, the Zuni names are very kind of standard kind of Japanese names, like the ones we think of today, like Hayakawa and things like that, Kawasaki. These are normal Zuni names. Zunis have also been sent to Japan and are sort of easily able to learn Japanese kind of thing. So you have a whole idea that the area around the Grand Canyon, around the Four Corners area, Flagstaff, also around Phoenix, all that area was much more developed 1,500 years ago. In fact, all around Phoenix, Phoenix is an aptly named city, there are ancient concrete canals that intersect all around Phoenix. And the modern city of Phoenix is still using these canals today. The Hohokam Indians who lived around Phoenix and Casa Grande, They irrigated the whole desert. They built three-story concrete buildings, like Casa Grande.
Let's find out if the Egyptians did come here, David, when we come back. How did they migrate here? We'll be back. We're with the great adventurer, David Hatcher Childress. David, if Egyptians migrated here to the North Americas, when might they have done it, and how do you think they got here?
Well, you know, probably the Egyptians came to the North America at least by about 1,000 B.C. That would be 3,000 years or so ago. They would naturally have come by boats. I mean, it's one of the enigmas of, say, the ancient Egyptians. You go to ancient Egypt, you see all this great dynastic architecture. They build these huge temples, pyramids, other buildings out of giant blocks of granite and basalt and limestone. But supposedly, though great architects and having, you know, quite an advanced science, the Egyptians didn't go anywhere. They did have large boats, but they didn't use them, supposedly. They were a very sort of insulated civilization, allegedly. Oh, just stayed in their own country and, you know, maybe made a few little exploratory adventures and things like that. That is basically your isolationist point of view. Most universities are teaching that, especially in the United States. That's the idea that civilizations are isolated from each other. They don't have much contact. Crossing oceans is very difficult. You can't just get in a boat, cross an ocean, and go somewhere. You have to walk places, allegedly. The flip side of that is diffusionism. It is, I'm more of a champion of that, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Thor Heyerdahl, the famous Norwegian archaeologist, who I met several times and was something of a hero of mine, he passed away a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Kon-Tiki fame?
Exactly. And he would build these balsa rafts, and he would build reed boats and things like that, and then he would sail them across the Atlantic or Pacific as far as he could, trying to prove that ancient people also got into boats. I mean, the whole idea that oceans are barriers, for Native Americans to get down to Central America or South America, they can't get in a boat and go there. They have to, like, walk for thousands of miles through hostile tribes. It would take them generations, where, in fact, being in a boat would be much faster, safer, easier to go places. And, I mean, and in fact, oceans are highways, not barriers. Getting into a boat and going someplace, that's an easy way to go places. Ancient Egypt was an unusual country, like ancient Israel. You had countries that had the ability to have a port on the Mediterranean, which the Egyptians did and the mm-hmm. ancient Hebrews, and you could have a port city on the Red Sea. And that would allow you to go out into the Indian Ocean. You could go down through East Africa. You could cross the Arabian Sea. You could go to Muscat. You could go to Persia, to India, to Sri Lanka, on to Australia, and of course, to Pacific Islands and to South America. Now, I mean, it's kind of interesting how archaeologists think, particularly the isolationists. One of the stories in the Bible is of King Solomon's mines and a trip to Ophir. And Ophir was a three-year journey. And it's talked about in the Old Testament in Kings. They would leave from Elat on the Red Sea, and they would go for one entire year out somewhere past India and Indonesia. There they would get exotic feathers. They would bring apes back, and they would bring back all this gold. And it was this gold that they brought back that built the first temple in Jerusalem. Now, here's the thing. You have the Bible saying, yeah, it's a three-year trip.
Right.
1 year to go there. 1 year. They would stay there 1 year, and then it would be 1 year back. Well, archaeologists were looking for Ophir and King Solomon's mines, and where they think they are, they found a gold mine in Saudi Arabia. So they thought, oh, well, this has to be King Solomon's mines. This is Ophir. And others would say, oh, well, they went to Somalia or some area like that in East Africa. Well, there's a problem with that, and that is that, I mean, those places are only a few days' sail from a lot in the Red Sea. I mean, they're not even several weeks of voyaging in actuality. In a year, the ancient Phoenicians and Hebrews who were going on these journeys to Ophir, I mean, they could easily have gone as far as Australia, for instance.
Sure.
And even, as I say in my book on Mystery of the Olmecs and also my other books on lost cities of ancient Lemuria in the Pacific, that they were the ancient Egyptians, the Chinese, many other ancient civilizations. They were going out into the ocean. They were going out into the Pacific. This is one of the solutions, too, to many of the pyramids and megaliths on remote Pacific islands. Tonga, there's this giant city built out of basalt crystals in Micronesia, a city called Nan Madol. That city is like the eighth wonder of the world. The majority of it is actually built into the ocean. Archaeologists estimate there's 150 million tons of basalt that's stacked up into artificial islands and walls and buildings on Pohnpei in Micronesia. And this incredible city, I mean, it's actually built into the ocean. It's not even on the island. They don't know who built this. I mean, archaeologists are saying, okay, these kind of like Easter Island, where you have a remote island, it has giant megalithic remains on it. But mainstream archaeologists, their explanation is, well, you know, these islanders just kind of got to this Polynesians to some remote island, and they were bored.
And
they had nothing else to do, so they built these giant statues. They built this huge city.
Well, all right, in this particular case with the Egyptians ending up in the Grand Canyon, where would they have set sail from Egypt? Where do they land, and why walk or travel all the way to the Grand Canyon from there?
Well, you know, I mean, and that's interesting, too. They may not have had to have walked all that way. I mean, today, all this area around here, Yuma, Palm Springs, very much the inland areas of Southern California and western Arizona, I mean, it is trackless desert. There's no rivers around there at all, except for the Colorado River coming out of the Grand Canyon. In ancient times, and in my book on lost cities of North and Central America, I actually have maps and stuff in there of this. The whole West was much different in ancient times, and California especially. If you look at a good relief map of California, you can see instantly what it was like even just a few thousand years ago, and that is that Central California was a huge inland sea. And all around Fresno and that area, I mean, that's what they call the Central Valley. I mean, if ocean levels or California had just, you know, had been shifted a little bit, that whole area would be flooded, not only from the Golden Gate area, but also up from the south, the Salton Sea, areas like that. And, in fact, there were Finger Lakes already going up into Nevada. I did a show for the Discovery Channel and the Learning Channel, and it was all about giants and the legends and lore of giants. They flew me to Reno, where we went to Lovelock, Nevada, which is right near where they do the Burning Man festival now every summer.
Right.
And but what is in Lovelock is fascinating, because in Lovelock is a state park known as the Lovelock Caves. And in those caves, what happened was these ranchers began excavating this cave at the turn of the century, and they were looking for bat guano. And there was just tons of bat guano inside these caves. And as they started digging out the caves, they started finding artifacts. Now, the Paiute legends of that area had talked about these red-haired giants coming by boat up around Lovelock. You couldn't do that today. Try and go by boat from the ocean to Lovelock. I mean, it's a thousand miles of desert.
Can't do it, yeah.
That's right. So their legend was that these giants, red-haired giants, came in boats. Even that area around Lovelock is still some lakes that are drying up today. And, I mean, there's just some marshes there that are the remains of these ancient lakes. And archaeologists and geologists say, yeah, there were lakes there, although, I mean, it's a problem with geology. Geologists think everything's millions of years ago, when, in fact, these lakes couldn't have been that long ago, because the Paiute Indians still had legends and stuff of it. I mean, it was only some hundreds of years ago, maybe 1,000 or something like that. Well, so the Indians have these legends of the red-haired giants. When these ranchers began digging out the bat guano in the Lovelock Cave, they started finding duck decoys, baskets, all kinds of hunting and fishing tools for a large lake. And then, incredibly, they found a number of skeletons. And these skeletons were like 7 foot tall people. They had long red hair. They dragged like a dozen of these skeletons out of the cave. This all was around the turn of the century. Get this, George. There are two museums in Nevada today, one in Lovelock, one in Winnemucca. Those museums are wholly dedicated to the finds that were found in Lovelock Cave. The excavations were done by the University of California at Berkeley, actually did the excavations. They know that these things came out of these caves. People at the museum talked about a photo of a rancher standing on a crate holding one of these giants by the hair. And I mean, this thing is huge, and, you know, 7 feet tall. That is a large person with red hair.
Right. And at that time, that was really a giant.
And here's the thing. That photo of that giant, every single one of these giant skeletons is utterly missing. No one knows not only where the skeletons are, they don't even know where photos of them are, okay? There's two museums in Nevada that are all about these discoveries. So here you have a double enigma and then a triple one where there's apparently some kind of cover-up and these rather unusual items have just vanished. But you have these giants, they had red hair, they sound like Vikings or something like that, actually. And on top of that, they apparently were going by boat up into, you know, the Black Rock Desert of Nevada. How about that? So as I chronicled all that, apparently California has been drying up for several thousand years. These lakes have been drying up. There was used to be, in the 1800s, there was a big lake around Fresno called Tulare Lake. That lake is not there today, but there used to be big sailing ships and stuff like that on that lake in the, like, mid-1800s.
Sounds like we're going the way of Mars, David.
Well, I mean, that is what is happening to this planet, and places like Chad, Lake Chad, they've been saying now, which is in the kind of southern Sahara. That lake has been drying up now for the last 50 years. It's only about a quarter of what it used to be. And, you know, it's fine that people should be concerned about the planet drying up and certain lakes going, but throughout history, this is what's been going on. And in California and this area, yeah, there used to be all these lakes, the Salton Sea. In my book on Lost Cities of North and Central America, I have a couple of chapters where I talk about weird ships out in the desert. And these are mainly around Southern California, some of them as Spanish.
Right in the middle of the desert, right?
Yeah, ships out in the desert, that's right. And there's a number of stories along those lines. They know that some of these occurred. A similar thing like this was there was another lake also around Baker, California, and along the Death Valley is very much like this. But there, back in the late 1800s, this lake still existed, and it was a long lake, and they still ran a paddle steamer on it. And one winter, this paddle steamer was taking a load of gold from some mines in Nevada. It sank in a storm on the lake and was gone. That lake then dried up over the next 40 years, and then in the 1930s, one of the early California aviators went out flying over the Southern California desert, and lo and behold, he sees like a riverboat steamer with a paddle wheel out in the desert, covered with, you know, partially covered with sand. And that's how they discovered that ship, and it had a lost gold. This is like, you know, 1928 or something.
That is, all right, so let's assume they were able to boat their way up. Why keep it a secret, David? If the Smithsonian confiscated all these artifacts, mummies and tablets and things like that, why keep it a secret?
Well, there's a number of reasons for that. But part of it is, and it's the same reason why a lot of things today would be kept a secret, they're engineering history. And today, history is politically correct. Not necessarily what really happened in the past. It's more like what they want to have happened, or how politically correct they want, certain native to be, or something like that. Another problem, particularly out west, was the Mormons. And of all the states in the United States, you've got the universities basically teaching isolationism. That is, certainly Egyptians didn't come to North America or South America. They didn't travel. Chinese people didn't get in boats and go places. all the Native Americans walked from Siberia down through Canada, down to South America. But in Utah, they don't teach that. And the Mormon religion, which is, you know, pretty interesting in itself. I'm not a Mormon, but I grew up in Colorado, so I've spent a lot of time around Utah and Mormons, and I'm quite familiar with their history. They claim that, yeah, the Egyptians and lost tribes of Israel, that they escaped from the Middle East. They got into boats. They crossed the Mediterranean, then crossed the Atlantic. They landed in Mexico. These were the Nephites and the Jaredites. They then fought all these battles. I mean, you can add to that, as far as I'm concerned, Chinese coming here, Egyptians, Polynesians. You've got Basque sailors and even African kingdoms and stuff like that. But so here is a problem with, say, the Smithsonian and mainstream history, is that suddenly a find like this, that the Egyptians would say were in the Grand Canyon, say that Romans came to Arizona. I go into this in my book as well. That is basically major ammunition for the Mormons. I mean, this is what they've been saying. They're saying, yeah, this is what the Book of Mormon says. Mm-hmm. It says people crossed the ocean. It says Romans came here and Jews came here and stuff. And, you know, see, Book of Mormon must be right. And so the Smithsonian and other powers that be, they're not wanting to give credence to the Book of Mormon, which these finds, you know, would kind of do. And, you know, as an archaeologist, I read all kinds of archaeology books and history books, total fringe, you know, far out books, similar to the ones I write, and mainstream of all kinds, and the skeptical books, I read them all. And the Mormon archaeology books are quite interesting. And so these are sort of reasons why they want to have cover-ups. A similar thing happened in Brazil, let me tell you, just to show you how these things become politically correct or incorrect. Back in the 70s, the Brazilian Navy went out and they discovered there was a Roman shipwreck off of Rio de Janeiro. And it was underwater. The Navy went down diving on it. They found actually several boats. They started bringing up Roman amphora and Roman coins and stuff like that. America's most famous underwater archaeologist, a guy named Robert Marks.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, David, when we come back. Then we'll also get into the Olmecs. Who were the Olmecs? We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, David Hatcher Childress. David, did you want to finish your last thoughts before we move into the Olmecs at all?
Well, yeah. We were talking about how the Brazilian Navy had discovered these Roman shipwrecks off of Rio de Janeiro. But what happened in the end there, with this exciting archaeological discovery, was it became politicized, and that suddenly the Italian community in Brazil were saying, oh, well, hey, Romans discovered Brazil, in fact, you know, and in fact they should all get, you know, citizenship or whatever. And so what happened was the Brazilian government ordered the Navy to go out there, and they buried these Roman shipwrecks rather than excavate them. So that's how kind of things become politicized. You know, I thought it was interesting, Ulta, your commercial about gold, and we were talking about how the Egyptians and King Solomon and these guys, they went around the world looking for gold. Gold is indestructible. All the gold of ancient times still exists today. To the ancient peoples, including the Egyptians and the Olmecs, the ancient Israelis, it was gold. It was what really mattered to them. They were also searching for jade, was very valuable to them, exotic feathers.
If Zechariah Sitchin's right, the Anunnaki came here for gold as well.
That's right. That is part of, his whole cosmology, that the Anunnaki came to our planet. They're looking for gold. Ancient peoples have always sought after gold. And, in fact, in Peru, and this is one of the ideas, too, that the ancient land of Ophir that that the Egyptians and the King Solomon and the Phoenicians were going to was Peru. And in Peru, gold was so plentiful there in ancient times and right up to the time of the Spanish conquest that the Peruvians actually used gold as a like wallpaper. And the big temples and things like that in Cusco were lined with beaten gold. They had gold goblets and plates and everything like that. It was for the Spanish, you know, they went there and said, hey, just give us all of your, you know, dish pans and stuff like that. Well, and they just took them. And the Incas said, yeah, sure, have them, you know, and it was gold. But you see, it's kind of interesting. If in ancient times the King Solomon's navy and whatnot had traveled through the Red Sea, out through the Indian Ocean, and this is what the Bible says they did. Just how far they went is the question. But they could have easily have gone out then right between New Guinea and Australia, out into the Pacific. Next stops would have been Fiji and Tonga. From there, you would hit to Tahiti and the Marquesas, and then you would land in Peru. And if you got to Peru, man, you could easily fill up your ship with gold, which is what the Bible says they did, and then head on home. It was a three-year journey. So this is kind of what they were looking for. This is what the Egyptians were looking for in the Southwest. They were exploring. The Chinese, too, were doing similar things. And, in fact, there's been a number of pretty interesting books written just in the last few years about the Chinese circumnavigating the globe before Columbus, a lot of early voyages and things like that. And it's back to what I said earlier, how oceans are highways, not barriers. I mean, it's really unscientific for mainstream archaeologists to insist that ancient people couldn't get into boats and cross oceans. A couple years ago, a French guy swam across the Atlantic Ocean. How about that? I mean, people have crossed the Atlantic in kayaks, small rowboats. Young teenagers have circumnavigated the entire world by themselves in small yachts without GPS or any of that stuff. So, I mean, and that's part of the enigma, too, was that the ancient Egyptians, the ancient Chinese, the Phoenicians, Romans, they had huge ships, gigantic ships that held 300 or 400 people. In Tonga, they had giant ships like that, too, that were going. I mean, they were much bigger than any ships that Columbus had. You now get into things like the Piri Reis map and the maps of the ancient sea kings by Charles Hapgood.
Oh, yeah, that map is incredible.
Well, right, and it seems that even like Columbus and other people, they had some of these old maps, and they were kept secret, too. This was one of the things about a lot of the ancient sea routes and things like that. They were kept secret. The Phoenicians kept secrets. The Phoenician sailors were not allowed to talk about where they went and the ports that they went to. There's a certain a theory, that, and I also go for this, that the Toltecs, whose capital was Tula in northern Mexico, they're related to a lot of the stuff here in Arizona. They conquered Chichen Itza in the Yucatan at one point. The Toltecs are depicted as guys with thick beards and mustaches. They wear helmets. They carry swords and shields. They look like Phoenicians. They look like Mediterranean warriors and stuff.
Persians, everything like that.
Stuff like that, right.
Yeah,
and in fact, it seems that probably the Toltecs were some offshoot of the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, who had already a transatlantic trade. Another similar thing there is the Phoenicians were known as the purple people, and they wore purple robes. And even the whole concept today of kings and queens wearing purple gowns and purple crowns and things like that, that comes from the Phoenicians, who all wore purple. And that purple color was a very special dye that they got from a shellfish. And that was a secret technique of taking this dye. Phoenicians were famous for it, and the Carthaginians were also Phoenicians. But also the Mayans. used also this purple dye, this same unusual shellfish dye, which the Phoenicians had a secret. Another curious thing along this line with the Egyptians and stuff is boomerangs. We often we think of boomerangs as being some kind of Australian aboriginal
device.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But boomerangs have been found all over the world. And, in fact, the Egyptians hunted with boomerangs. King Tut, in his tomb in Egypt, there was a trunk full of boomerangs that was found in his tomb. It's part of the Tutankhamun treasure. And, in fact, it's if you go to the Cairo Museum and you go to the Tutankhamun area, you will see on display all of his boomerangs. And he was a boomerang nut. He didn't just have a couple of boomerangs. He had a whole trunk full of dozens of them. It's well known that the Egyptians hunted with boomerangs. But if you go also down to museums like the Mexico City Museum for the Aztecs and Zapotecs and Toltecs, you'll also see boomerangs on display there. And the Hopi Indians, who live here in northern Arizona near the Grand Canyon, they supposedly were the keepers of this secret Egyptian city in the Grand Canyon. And the Hopis also hunt with boomerangs, and they were famous for that. Prior to the Spanish conquest, that's what young Hopi warriors did. They went out with boomerangs and hunted birds and rabbits and things like that.
All right, let's talk about the Olmecs, if we can. Who were the Olmecs, David?
You know, the Olmecs are a very recent civilization to us. Prior to really 1940, the Olmecs were completely unknown. Up to that time, the archaeologists believe that the oldest civilization that was in Central America was the Mayans. And the Mayans went back to, at that time, they were saying, well, the Mayans went back to, say, 500 BC, 800 BC, something like that. Well, what happened was, in the 1930s, art experts in the United States began realizing that there was this style of art coming out of Mexico that was totally unique, and it wasn't Mayan, and it wasn't Aztec or Zapotec or Mixtec. It was this very unusual and distinctive kind of art, statues, jade artifacts, things like that. And this is how they found the Olmecs. But, and the look of the Olmecs is very curious. The most famous things of the Olmecs are what we call the colossal heads, these gigantic basalt heads. They weigh 20 tons, and they look like Nigerian rugby players or something.
Hmm.
They're wearing helmets. They look very, very African. They have the typical Negroid wide nose and thick lips. When you see these guys, they don't look like Mayans. They look extremely African, although some Olmecs also look very Oriental. They look very Chinese. Even other Olmecs have beards and mustaches. They look more like Mediterraneans, Phoenicians, and things like that. So in 1940, what happened was the archaeologists in Mexico had a special conference, and they called archaeologists from all over the world. And at that time, they gave them all this evidence for the Olmecs. They said, yeah, there's this other culture that's older than the Mayans, that's older than every culture that we can find in Central America. And in fact, this ancient culture that now we're going to call it the Olmecs, the rubber people, they're the ones who, in fact, created the calendar. They created the number system. They created the ball game. Many of the early Mayan cities, like those, like Huaxacan, deep in the Petén jungles of Guatemala, they're saying now that, yeah, that was originally an Olmec city, but eventually became a Mayan city. The Olmecs themselves go back, they're saying, to about 1,500 BC. The Olmecs are characterized by, again, this really unusual facial features. They often have this frown. They look like they're Africans. And they have the cone heads. They have this elongated skulls. Very curious to see. And as you can see, George, in my book, Mystery of the Olmecs, there's a lot of pictures of these guys, and they're really strange looking.
Are they from this planet?
Well, boy, when you see some of these guys, and they're heavy, elongated heads, I mean, they've, for whatever reason, they have either bound the heads as babies, or else they naturally look like this, but their cranial capacity is like double that of a normal human.
Yeah.
And people look like this all over the world. Akhenaten and Nefertiti, Egyptians did this as well. Tutankhamun himself was also what we'd call a cone head, head binding. Then the dolichocephalus is the technical term for that, where you have an elongated cranium. I have a whole chapter in Mystery of the Olmecs about this, and the more you look into this whole thing of head binding, of shaping these long of cone head craniums, the weirder that gets. Because
I'm not sure that they made these. These look like they're genetic mutations, or they came from someplace else.
When you see them, they look like aliens, and that's been a natural assumption, because when you see some of these skulls and the figurines and things like that come out of Mexico, also South America, yes, you're right. I mean, they look like they're extraterrestrials. I mean, they look
at the size of the eye sockets, David. They're huge.
Well, that's right. And, I mean, these are not the kind of guys you're going to want to meet in a dark alley. They look like something out of, like, these alien movies or something like that. And, in fact, that Swiss artist, Geiger, who created that kind of look of these long-headed sort of insectoid aliens in that movie. But that is what these guys look like. And when you show photos of just your typical Olmecs, they're some weird-looking guys. I mean, you can hardly believe it.
Are you familiar with Lloyd Pye's work in The Star Child?
Yes, I am. And
very similar skull.
Well, right, and his skull, and I've been privileged to examine the Star Child skull myself. I've met Lloyd a couple of times, and that is a really unusual skull, and that's the kind of thing we're talking about, where you have these really strange skulls. Some are smashed sideways, kind of like his Star Child skull is like that, and there are you will see in. Particularly in Mexico and in Peru, you will see in museums some of these skulls, and some are really shocking to see. They're just so bizarre. We don't know why people did that. Now, it may be that some of these people really were extraterrestrials. That's just how they naturally looked. We know that at least in some cases, the Olmecs and the Mayans and people all over the world, in fact, were doing this, including the Kurds in northern Iraq, the Egyptians in Malta, they were doing this. People would shape young babies' skulls like this, at least in some cases. When you are still an infant, you have plates in your head, and they haven't fused yet. They're to allow your head to grow bigger, but eventually as an adult, the plates in your head do fuse together. Prior to that, you can work with the head, and we know that in some cases people did this.
Can you make it that large? And what about the eye sockets? How do you make your eye sockets twice as big as a normal human?
Well, that's a good question. With the deformation of these skulls, it would deform the eye sockets too, and even it would have been a problem in some cases, you would think, for that their heads would have become so heavy, and the back of their heads are extended like twice as far as ours. I mean, it's pretty obvious when you see these weird skulls like this, that would have been even hard for them just to hold their heads up. If you look at statues of Nefertiti, of Akhenaten, Tutankhamun, their daughters, Meretaten and Mekhetaten, they also have these really weird elongated skulls. I mean, maybe they were extraterrestrials too, and that has been suggested, of course. But there are ways. I mean, maybe they were trying to copy these extraterrestrials, or they were...
Right, that's possible.
Right. Some of these people probably were humans, and...
Or maybe hybrids?
Hybrids, right. And, you know, even... You know, and I know Zachariah Sitchin, too, and I'm familiar with his work. It's quite interesting. I do disagree with him on a number of things. But, you know, the idea that these Anunnaki, some aliens are here, that they look like this, you know, they extraterrestrials don't necessarily look a whole lot different than we are. And, in fact, perhaps, you know, we are extraterrestrials, too, in that sense. But with these elongated skulls, this was really a hallmark of the Olmecs. And also a special frown that they had. There were certain looks. There was a V cleft also in their heads. Like they actually had, at least they depicted this kind of a cleft right at the top of their head. They did. The Olmecs did all kinds of weird stuff, including tattooing, piercing. They had Mohawk haircuts. A lot of the weird stuff that we do today, they were doing back then. And it kind of shows you, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. But a lot of these weird Olmec characters, you know, except for the really elongated heads, I mean, they would almost look like a modern guy walking down the street to Los Angeles or something.
Hey, David, when we come back, let's talk about the kind of technology that they might have had. And also, you know, you've done some work on lost cities. What about Atlantis? I got to talk with you about that, too. We'll be back in a moment. David Hatcher Childress, our guest on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest, David Hatcher Childress. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. But I've got more to talk with him about when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. David, can we speculate on what kind of technology the Olmecs had? What do you think?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the strange things that the Olmecs did was carve these giant heads out of basalt. And they weighed 20 tons. The basalt is extremely difficult rock to carve. It's so hard. So you have to look into that. I mean, the whole thing of moving giant megalithic blocks around, the Olmecs did that. Mexico does have megalithic cities, such as Monialban and Mitla, also La Venta, the center of the Olmecs. So you kind of, one of the things that we look at, and say with the Olmecs, with the Egyptians, ancient India, Atlantis, and whatnot, is what ancient people are able to do. And if you are able to take quarry a 100-ton block of granite or basalt, move that 20 miles, stack it up in a giant wall, places like Baalbek, Peru, Mexico, certain Pacific islands, I mean, you're in Egypt, of course. What you're doing is something that even modern construction companies wouldn't do today. It's kind of the way we look at the past. And this was in my book, Technology of the Gods. This was the subject I tackled was, okay, we perceive ancient civilizations as being primitive. The way that modern historians paint the past to us is, well, 8,000 years ago, people were cavemen, very primitive. Then suddenly they just stepped out of their caves, started building ziggurats and pyramids and things like that. And lo and behold, here we are, modern man with all of this cool stuff that we have. But really, the ancient civilizations weren't like that. There's a roller coaster of ups and downs. That's what the graph of history would read. We would have times of enlightenment and science, these golden ages of legends. But then there have been crashes, and this happened with the Olmecs too, where suddenly these guys are moving giant heads around, they're carving huge statues, then moving giant blocks around. You see this, say, in Peru, and then suddenly it all just stopped. Some cataclysm just halted all the workers. They left huge blocks the size of a semi-truck just lying on roads and things like that. They had wall or something that they were making. In Technology, the Gods, and in all my books on Lost Cities, what I try and point out is that people would not be building, like the Olmecs, with giant blocks of basalt or granite. I mean, some of these things weigh 100 tons. The giant blocks at Baalbek in Lebanon, these weigh 1,000 tons. 100,000 tons, which would be 200,000 pounds. Even modern cranes wouldn't try and lift and move these blocks, yet ancient people were doing that. And you have to ask the question, why would the Olmecs or the ancient Peruvians or other people on these Pacific islands and stuff, why would they want to go around and build with 100-ton blocks, 20-ton blocks? It seems incredible. They don't have to build like that.
Right.
I mean, we don't do that today. We don't. The construction companies don't go around hauling around 20-ton blocks and stacking them up, maybe for the Lincoln Monument or the Jefferson Memorial or something like that. So you have to ask yourself. I mean, and this is what, say, Zachariah Sitchin would do, Eric Von Däniken, myself, Graham Hancock. And that is, why are they doing this? It's because they've apparently chosen to do something so incredibly hard. Even today, we would find it so difficult with all of our modern equipment. Yet they were trying to do that. It would seem that somehow they were able to do these things easier than us, and that what seemed so incredibly difficult was easy for them. I mean, it's like they had to have some kind of anti-gravity, some sort of levitation device that made these stones weightless. This island that I was talking about earlier, Nan Madol, on Ponape Island in Micronesia, The legend of that island, this city built of 150 million tons of basalt and 100 artificial islands in the ocean, the legends on that island are that those stones flew through the air. And in fact, archaeologists don't even know where they got all of the basalt that they used in this city. It's like entire mountains of basalt would be dismantled to create the city of Nan Madol. And the natives are saying, yeah, with the stones flew magically through the air, some kind of a levitation, stacking these things up. When you see the huge walls, like at Ollantaytambo in Peru, Tiwanaku as well in Bolivia, stuff in Egypt and Baalbek, what we're talking about, there's plenty of other places. When you see that, I mean, it only makes sense that they could have somehow made these huge stones weightless. NASA has even done experiments like that of acoustic levitation and stuff like that. Sound waves can make things lose weight. They're constantly doing studies like this. They had to have something like that. In my book, Technology of the Gods, I actually go into a whole chapter about Vimanas, that they had ancient aircraft. When you read the...
That's an incredible story. Talk about that for a little bit, David, okay?
Sure. You know, when you read the ancient Hindu epics, the Mahabharata, part of that is the Ramayana, they read like the wildest science fiction.
They really do, yeah.
And Rama, these ancient Hindu kings and other people, they get into these airships. They're called in Sanskrit Vimanas. In ancient Hindu epics and stuff, they talk about these a lot. Rama, in the story of the Ramayana, this is all supposed to be 10,000 years ago or more, his wife runs away from him. He goes into the Ayodhya forest in northern India, meditates for a while. He's bummed out because his wife left him. Then after a couple of years, he actually, you know, decides, I'm going to go get her back. He gets in his Vimana, this aircraft. He flies to Sri Lanka, battles with this Ravana guy who's stolen his wife. He gets her back, takes her back to northern India, all in his Vimana and these airships. Also, in the Mahabharata, they talk about these airships fighting battles. Their horrific wars are fought. Entire cities are just decimated by the weapons in these craft. And then, you know, in fact, an entire book was discovered in ancient India about Vimanas. When you read some modern novel where the hero, James Bond, gets onto a British Airways flight, flies to Switzerland or something, you know, the author's not going to suddenly stop and tell you what an airplane is and describe it and how airplanes work and all that kind of stuff. They know that you know, so all they have to do is just mention an airplane, and you know what they're talking about. And that's how the ancient Indian epics were, too. They talked about these Vimanas, these airships, but they didn't go into great detail about them because they knew that you knew what they were. Finally, in 1908, this ancient book from the 4th century B.C. called the Vimanika Shastra was found in this library in India, and it said that it was a book taken from older books, and that it was all about Vimanas, and it talked about different kinds of Vimanas. They were these metal craft. It talked about propulsion. Mercury was part of it. It talked about electricity. There was even stuff about the weapon system and stuff like that in the Vimanika Shastra. There weren't any illustrations, and it was basically an archaic Sanskrit. Then modern Sanskrit scholars were translating it. And it's, in India, this is a popular subject. Every single Hindu or Buddhist in India knows what a Vimana is, knows the stories. They're familiar with that whole story. Now, what happened then? British and Indian and Pakistani archaeologists began excavating these cities out in the Thar Desert between India and Pakistan right after World War II. These were just cities out in the desert, and in fact, they were made out of fine brick. They discovered them because they were looting brick from these cities to build some of the railroads in Pakistan. When the British archaeologists got to the city streets in the late 40s in these excavations in India and Pakistan, people were just lying dead in the streets, just like the ancient Indian epics had said. This doom had taken over cities like Mohenjo-Daro, Harappa, Kodigi, and it was, as the ancient Indian epics had talked about, these horrific wars, these cities were devastated. And that's what they discovered. People were just lying dead in the streets. And they found these melted glass blobs that turned out to be melted ceramics. Some super heat had also destroyed these cities. It was like kind of like atomic devastation. And in fact, no one came and buried the dead or anything. In the dead people just lying in the streets. Then the desert came in, covered them with sand, and for thousands of years, these cities just sat there until the excavation in the 40s. It's an interesting thing here, too, George, is that
it is fascinating stuff, David.
Well, and what's important about, say, the ancient Indian epics, Vimanas, ancient India itself, throughout history, knowledge and libraries have been destroyed. There have been great libraries in Egypt, in China, also in Mexico, and all over the world. The Library at Alexandria held hundreds of thousands of volumes on history and science and technology and stuff like that. All those books were destroyed in, you know, like the 3rd century A.D. The Emperor Qi Wang Ti of China, the same emperor who built the Great Wall and has the terracotta warriors that are so famous, he ordered every book in China destroyed, like 500 B.C. The Spanish, when they conquered Mexico, they gathered all of the Mayan codexes, the hieroglyph books of the Mayans, and destroyed them all. There's only 4 known Mayan books still in existence. So throughout history, I mean, this is one of the problems with trying to piece together what's happened. History's been purposefully destroyed, where the dictator of the time literally orders all books destroyed so that history will start again with them. India is one of the few countries where there's really still a continual line of knowledge and language going back thousands of years. And this is with the Vimanika Shastra book. Sanskrit scholars today can still read these really ancient books. But that is unique. In ancient Egypt or in China and places like that, I mean, people, they have some early hieroglyphs and scripts, but people cannot read them. So,
you know, Michael Cremo thinks we are hundreds of millions of years old. I'm beginning to think he may be right.
You know, and that's in his books, too, and I know Michael Cremo, and also in my book on Technology of the Gods. Yeah, you look at some of these unusual artifacts. I mean, there's metal objects, chains, metal balls, and things like that. And here in North America, there's been a number of stories like that, where it's your typical lump of coal kind of story, and inside of it is a nail or a gold chain or something like that. And, of course, when geologists are saying, well, you know, all this stuff's millions of years old. I mean, that lump of coal is millions of years old. The, some geological formation that they've blasted out. Yeah, I mean, and so, I mean, if that's the case, if everything really is, you know, millions and millions of years old, then when they find artifacts that are man-made or artificial in some way, yeah, I mean, that's an indication that mankind or some other race was occupying this planet, yeah, before we got here. There's that strange story, too.
Okay, Morrison, I wish we could, this is some very, very interesting stuff. But we've come to the end of the evening, and I appreciate you all for tuning in to tonight's broadcast. And don't forget to access the most awesome library. This one hasn't been destroyed. This one is growing. Just go to TahakaArchives.org, and after you do that, contact me directly. Tahaka Monterey Bay at area code 904-303-9061, and always try to call me before 7 p.m. Eastern Time. I thank you all. It's been a pleasure, and you all have a good evening. Okay.